I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. A whole lineup of folks to talk about the stuff that's going on. Ethan Pollack, senior policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, is going to talk about Paul Ryan's insane, destructive budget, and also what's going to happen if the T-Twizzlers and the Republicans hold up raising the debt ceiling. What does that look like for the country? Also on the program, we're going to talk with Susan Gobeski. She's executive director of Education Voters of Pennsylvania. Today, the SB1 bill, the voucher bill, the lottery ticket bill, exited the Appropriations Committee, going to go to the full Senate for a vote sometime later this week. So we want to get on top of that. Also, we're going to talk with Kevin Cicek, recording secretary and business agent of Teamsters Local 776, that big rally today in Harrisburg against the no rights at work agenda pushed by the Daryl Metcalfs of the world and the other corporate tools on the Republican Party. Also, Roland Zullo, he's going to be here talking about his research about right-to-work states and how in right-to-work states, construction workers get killed more often. I don't know if that is going to wake anybody up, but I hope so. Also in the third hour, Karen Tumlin, she's an attorney from Los Angeles, talking about the decision today by the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Ninth Circuit, which upheld the injunction against Arizona's SB 1070. That and your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Hope everyone had a great weekend. It's time to get back down to business. You know, over the weekend, I'm trying to put together this whole game plan. We've been seeing it across numerous states. It started in Wisconsin, went to Ohio, Michigan. We're seeing it in Washington and Maine. All across the country, the Republicans have basically set up this model, which is create a crisis. And now, look, I'm not the one who dreamt this up. If you read Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, you'll get it. But they set up this crisis. And if you go back to the Bush tax handouts, the crisis was starving the government. The crisis was creating a massive deficit and basically enriching your friends. I mean, if you stop and think about it, the Bush tax handouts, we gave out $1.7 trillion, then went and borrowed that much money just to replenish what we were already supposed to be in the coffers. And then, boom, there you go, almost $3.5 trillion in debt. You throw on the extra trillion or two amongst friends for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and all of that, and boom, you've got yourself a real problem. Instant creation of crisis. And they've been doing this around the states. One of the things Scott Walker did right when he took office is he handed out a bunch of money to corporations, created this artificial need for slashing, this artificial deficit that wasn't there before. Started talking about pension plans that are in trouble, and Wisconsin has one of the strongest pension plans in the country. They're 99.7% funded. No crisis there. None. But they had to create one. They had to create this aura of crisis to get people willing to say, oh, we got this problem. We need to fix it because Americans solve problems. We see a crisis, we jump in with both hands and we fix it. So they knew that the average American was going to say, well, you know what, times are tough. I don't want to slam down to my kids. We're going to tighten our belts now. You know, even me. And I said, look, you know, if times are tough, let's take care of it now. But the more you look at what's going on, the more you look at state after state after state following the exact same playbook. Wisconsin cutting $1 billion from education. Washington state cutting $1 billion in education. Pennsylvania, $1 billion in education. So you've got to wonder who it is that wrote this, because look, it cannot be that uniform from state to state to state to state without having a master plan. And I was watching this film over the weekend, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And they were talking about lobbyists and how quite often the bills that congressional people put forth, written by lobbyists. So you look at this grand scheme, you look at this big game plan, and you go, gee, where could something like that come from? And we know where it came from. It came from a place like the Heritage Foundation or the American Enterprise Institute, one of these radical, way-out right-wing groups who cater to business interests. And, you know, the more I've been running this through, because it's infuriating to me, the more you talk to people, the less they seem to know about this whole big game plan, which is to put corporations at the top of the heap, which I would argue they're already there. I would argue that, you know, I was talking to someone today who was saying, gee, you know, I wish we could just get U.S. companies to come back. If we had to lower our tax rates, you know, to entice them back, we should do that. And I'm going, what part of zero taxation don't you get? General Electric paid zero. How much less than zero can we pay? Oh, let me tell you how much less. Not only did they make billions in profit, we gave them billions in incentives to stay, and they still left. Closed 28 plants in the last 2 years. So, you know, I'm trying to have this discussion, and this person's got it in their head that if we use this tax policy, we can entice them back. And I'm going, you cannot do that, because zero isn't low enough taxes. What they will then want are all the incentives of the beggar thy neighbor situation that they've set up. You know, I asked them, I said, you know, here in Carlisle, do you think Carlisle Tire and Wheel would have stayed if we gave them tax rebates for 25 years? Do you think they would have stayed? He said, I don't know. I said, no, it was offered. Do you think if we gave them another, you know, several million dollars, they would have stayed? Because no taxes, extra couple million dollars, you think they stayed? I don't know. Well, no, they wouldn't, because we offered. So they went to Tennessee, got a boatload of cash, some $34 million, I've heard, plus tax abatements, plus land grants, plus all kind of stuff, all kind of goodies to put in the bag. Who pays for that? You and I do, because we're being business friendly. Again, I ask, how much more business friendly do we have to be? And it takes me back to this situation in Wisconsin, where they've made up this crisis. And to a T, every Republican and a lot of Democrats have fallen into this frame of, we're broke. And we're not broke. As numerous people have pointed out, broke means you can't pay your bills. Broke means you don't know how you're going to keep the light on. Broke means no food on the kitchen table. That's broke. We're in a situation where we've handed out our revenue. The revenue that was supposed to come into the coffers is now given away in the hopes and prayers that if we fill the investor class's coffers to the till, if we fill it all the way to the top, and that which brims over will be our bounty. Well, you know what? It never brims over. That pit is a bottomless pit. It never ends. And the greed on Wall Street never is going to end. And our problem is that we've got an electoral system that is based on who can raise the most money to buy the most TV ads to get elected. That's our problem. So is it any surprise that we don't have an awful lot of people concerned about the $8 or $10 an hour worker? Do you think it's of any major concern that the $12 an hour worker isn't high on the list of concerns of your congressman or your senator? Of course it's not surprising. But this frame they've created, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. We're broke. We're broke. So we have to do all of these outrageous things, like sell off assets, sell off our liquor stores, even though we have no idea what we'll get for them, especially in a down economy. We need to sell off our turnpike. We need to do all of this drastic stuff. And what? Because we're broke. We need to cut education by $1 billion. We need to cut higher education by 54%. Because we're broke. But we're willing to give out hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks to corporations in the hope that they'll reinvest in equipment they were going to buy anyway. And we refuse to tax the Marcellus Shale, where they're drilling at an alarming pace. And you know what's odd? Is somebody is paying that tax rate that we're not getting. It's just going into the pockets of the investor class. Because understand, that gas does not stay here. That gas is going international. That gas is all over the world. Somebody's paying that tax. They're paying it because everybody else taxes it. It's just that we're not reaping the benefits of it. In fact, it's not only that we're not reaping the benefits, we are being saddled with all of the risk. So I ask you, where can I get a business like that? How can I set up a gig like that for myself where I reap all the rewards and I suffer no consequence? Where I can fill my pockets and nothing ever has to come out. Where can I get a gig like that? So when we talk about this budget in the next segment, when we talk about this budget where it's, well, we have to cut because we're broke, stop and ask yourself, why aren't we taxing the very wealthy? Why aren't we slashing subsidies to oil companies? Why aren't we ending the insane wars all over the world? Why aren't we getting the heck out of Dodge? Why aren't we investing in education? Why aren't we investing in health care? Those create jobs. Why aren't we doing that? Well, because those things don't seem to put enough campaign money into the pockets of people like House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, who has put forth one of the most draconian, one of the most, really, honestly and truthfully, the worst budgets I think you could possibly put out. The destruction of Medicare and Medicaid. $6 trillion in slashing, and I wouldn't even say slashing. I would say chainsawing. You know, they say the scalpel or a machete. This guy's going with a dull, rusty old chainsaw. I'm hoping America wakes up. I'm hoping that they realize this is no good for us. No good at all. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ethan Pollack, senior policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. We're right back after this.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Washington State Capitol building in Olympia was buzzing last week with raucous protests. Chants that filled the Marble Building's rotunda echoed those heard in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and more. In a move similar to Wisconsin, the Capitol was even occupied overnight by protesters wanting their voices to be heard in the morning sessions. The issues at stake in Washington mostly revolve around budget proposals by both Republicans and Democrats that would see social services and education funding slashed without any tax breaks or loopholes being addressed. Democrats hold a slight majority in both houses of the legislature, but due to a referendum passed in November, no taxes can be raised in the state without a two-thirds majority. That means the only way to balance the budget in the state without such a majority is by making drastic cuts. Some of the tax breaks protesters have recommended the legislature cut include incentives for filmmaking in the state and plastic surgery. Healthcare workers in the state went on strike Thursday to have their voices heard in the Capitol, even disrupting the House session to the point where they were asked to leave the gallery. Maureen Masterson is a clinician with Compass Health.
To deny seniors the right to remain in their homes with adequate trained care.
Right.
To deprive people who the right to have medical treatment and medication that they need. That's not a budget. That is immoral. Shame on you.
Shame on you!
Even as teacher unions are under unprecedented attacks to strip their union rights, the American Federation of Teachers is making significant gains organizing charter schools in Chicago. Doug Cunningham files this report.
Chicago has 85 charter schools. AFT so far has organized 12 of them and intends to unionize them all. The Chicago Alliance of Charter Teachers and Staff is a united effort by the Chicago Teachers Union and the State and National American Federation of Teachers. The growing charter school movement often scapegoats teacher unions and diverts funds away from public education. Nationwide right now, more than 600 charter schools are unionized, but that's a small percentage of the total number of charter schools. The latest charter school to see teachers forming a union in Chicago is the Chicago Math and Science Academy, but so far the administration there is refusing to recognize the teachers' union. Even as the AFT organizes more charter schools, the administrations of those charter schools in the city, by and large, are still anti-union and are fighting efforts by teachers and staff to get an organized voice on the job.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So on Friday, Friday night, many of us were relieved. The problem is the Democrats conceded enough to appease the Republicans into allowing our government to function for several more weeks before the next shutdown threat over the debt ceiling, a situation that really, honestly, and truthfully, all rational thinkers think is a no-brainer, that not raising the debt ceiling could be catastrophic, could be damaging to our economy. But those are rational thinkers. Our scorched earth radical GOP sees it as an opportunity to extract another pound of flesh from the American working class and grab the brass ring by destroying Medicare and going after Social Security. It's surely going to be interesting to watch. I mean, this is going to be interesting. The question is, who's going to stand up for the workers of this nation? And what will another shutdown threat do to our nation? Here to help me go through some of those questions is Ethan Pollack. He is a senior policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. EPI.org is their website. Ethan, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks, Pollack. Good to be here.
You know, in your piece, Ryan's budget would undermine economic security for millions, which is our link to our site at thericksmithshow.com. I got to ask you, how would it undermine economic security for millions?
Well, the Ryan budget does a number of huge cuts to the mainly to the social safety net that we have and have had in place since the 60s. It would voucherize, essentially privatize Medicare. It would basically give seniors money and then force them to then buy health insurance in the private market. And we all know how private insurance companies are, always play by the rules and, never abuse their patients. Well, imagine what happens when suddenly they have elderly patients that they can bilk. And then it also blocks grants on Medicaid, which creates this huge unfunded, liability for state and local, for state governments, and will, put them, about, $1.4 trillion in the red over the next, 10 years, forcing them to cut back not just on health coverage for the disabled and the elderly and the and children and pregnant women, but also then cut back on a variety of other things, including infrastructure and other types of social support and a lot of these programs that promote economic mobility. So it's really taking us back to really the 1950s.
So every time I use the Republican scorched earth frame of mind, I always get something from somebody complaining, "Oh, you're being too hard on them." But what you've laid out basically is scorched earth.
It absolutely is. No, this is not a place where you can have you can't really exaggerate when you talk about this stuff. It's kind of impossible to actually to overestimate exactly how much damage this will do to middle class households.
Now they have to know that this is going to do this damage, and I guess I would argue that that's their intention.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would not paint them as sadists who want to see people suffer. But I generally speaking, if you look at the policy agenda, it involves. I mean, take the Ryan budget. You got let me get the exact number here. You got $4.2 trillion in tax cuts. All right. And you've got $4.3 trillion in spending cuts. So you're actually only reducing the deficit by about $155 billion over the next 10 years. Now, that's peanuts. So, but the point is that really what they're doing is they're just cutting taxes, and then the way they finance that is cutting the spending. This is not about deficits. This is purely about cutting taxes on wealthy individuals and on corporations. And then making, middle class households, and the elderly and the disabled, all of these groups that, are some of the most disadvantaged of the entire population and putting them with the bill.
You know, here as the senior policy analyst over there at the Economic Policy Institute, tell me if I'm wrong. This has been something the Republicans have been pushing for 30 years, this idea that we can cut taxes and it's going to somehow magically create all of these jobs that will then fill the coffers again. I haven't found that works, yet they keep trying it over and over again, or am I missing something?
No, you're absolutely right. It doesn't work. I mean, the last two decades are a perfect example. You've got Bill Clinton and the Democrats in 1993, had a budget deal that, in part raised taxes on high earners, right? That then led, among other things, I don't want to say that was chiefly the cause of the boom in the mid to late 90s, but if you believe a lot of these right-wingers, they would say that would preclude any type of economic boom. And that's just, obviously we saw that not happen. You increased taxes, and you actually had this huge boom, all right? Now, the reverse was also true. You cut taxes under Bush in 2001, and over his entire administration, you had such a small amount of job gain. I think it was like a tenth of what Bill Clinton had during his presidency. And you had median incomes, stagnate. Middle-class families were not seeing any of the gains that were going on in the economy. So it is clear that these types of tax cuts that they push do little to actually spur economic growth, let alone then pay for themselves. But they do a lot in terms of redistributing wealth from the middle-class household and towards the people that are already very well off.
Yep, exactly. A second ago, I said that the Republicans had to know that this is scorched earth and that this is going to cause problems. And you kind of, disagreed just a little bit that, they maybe don't believe that entirely. But you point out in your article in the late 1950s, 35% of the elderly population were in poverty compared to today, just 9%. And you say 75% reduction. I look at something like that and point to Social Security and Medicare as the reason why those folks are not living in poverty. So by them wanting to destroy these programs tells me that they want to go back to the way it used to be, the good old days.
I think they do want to go back to the good old days, and I think they've convinced themselves, and here I believe that there's good in everyone. I think that they've just convinced themselves the free market will just take care of it. Now, there's no historical data that there ever will be a situation which the free market will take care of the least advantaged people, among us, and that it'll just take care of the infrastructure. Somehow the infrastructure will be magically, built and repaired. The free market will have the incentive to do so despite all historical, precedent in economic theory. But nonetheless, I think that this is the Upton Sinclair, argument that, it's hard to convince someone of something when their paycheck depends on them not understanding it.
Right.
And I think this is similar here. I think that possibly, subconsciously, they have bought into this view because that's the key to their political success, and it makes the world just so much easier to them. It's really easy when your ideology and worldview means that you don't have to actually take responsibility for a lot of the problems in the world.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. In another piece you write, in the 1950s, 27% of children lived in poverty. Compare that with today, 21%. Tells me we haven't done a very good job helping children. Now we're talking about states across this country wanting to cut billions of dollars to education and to the Head Start programs. I think could make that much worse.
Yeah, it It absolutely would. You know, these investments in early child education, for example, just pay enormous dividends over time. I mean, this is it boggles my mind that some of these conservatives who profess to have this deep appreciation for the independent businessman, for example, well, here's a type of investment that pays for itself actually being in about 5-6 years or so, and over the course of 20-30 year period pays for itself like 8-10 times over. I mean, this is the type of high yield investment that we should really be targeting targeting our resources towards, and instead they want to cut it. I try to find the good in people. It's really hard when you're in this business, though.
Yeah, I hear you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Ethan Pollack, senior policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI.org. Let's talk about the debt ceiling for a second. I think we do have a debt crisis. I think we have a crisis that was created by giving away our wealth for a whole bunch of reasons, nebulous foreign policy gains, that we this bizarre need to have a billionaire class. But I don't believe the answer is slashing education and health care. I believe, maybe some additional revenue would help.
It absolutely would. right now, wealthy individuals are paying historically low average rates. So if you look at the total amount of taxes that they pay as a share of their income, the wealthiest 1% are paying as little as they have paid since 1979, with a couple of years exceptions in the mid 80s. But besides that, these are at historical lows, and especially when we have as high a debt and deficits that we do, it's amazing. You would expect them to pay historically more than the average, the whole shared sacrifice thing, and instead they're actually paying much less than the historical average. And the wealthiest 400 households, I think, are their average tax rate is something like 16-17%, according to the U.S. Treasury. So you're right, we absolutely need more revenues, and I think the first place we should go is to a lot of the wealthy individuals that have actually been doing incredibly well over the last decade. And then also to Wall Street. We've proposed a financial transactions tax, which would take a quarter percentage point off of each financial trade. Common sense things like that that I think really can go a long way towards closing the deficit, and do so in a way that really doesn't impact the middle class and the most vulnerable, who are especially the middle class, who are really kind of the where I think America really derives its economic strength.
Yeah, and talking about the transfer tax, I'm right there with you. It's something that is one of those revenue streams that's left off the table, because it's almost like the Republicans won't allow that to be taken care of, because they need the campaign cash. Explain to me, this debt ceiling thing. We've heard over and over again it would be a catastrophe if we did not raise the debt ceiling. Explain to me how it would look if we somehow defaulted on our bills.
Well, first off, not raising the debt ceiling doesn't necessarily mean default. what it means is we're essentially restricted to, we just can't have any deficit, so we're restricted to the revenues that are coming in. At a certain point, though, that's unsustainable. At a certain point, you need to pay contractors legally. I mean, the federal government, the longer it goes like that, the more it's going to be left open towards just a huge amount of legal liability. And eventually, yes, I mean, if it does not get raised for a period of time, then yes, the government will default, and that will have huge impact on not just the American economy, but on global financial markets, and could very easily sink us into another recession. So now, that said, I don't want to sound too alarmist, and the reason is because I think definitely Republicans are playing with fire here, but I think that Republicans have as much an interest not to plunge the U.S. into a default as the Democrats do, and I would hate to see Democrats so scared about this that they suddenly cave, like for the most part they did with the recent cut, and then with the December tackle. So I don't want to get people too scared about it. That said, it is, I think it's very telling that Republicans are willing to gamble on the debt ceiling, much of which, I mean, we got to remember, you know, the Bush tax cuts are still responsible for a huge amount of not just our debt, but also our deficits currently, because the, you know, both the amount of revenue that we're losing, but also all of the interest. You know, the debt stock is much higher now, and that means higher interest payments, and that goes straight to our deficit. If you break down the current year deficit, President Bush, his policies are actually still having a larger impact on the current deficit today than President Obama's policies are. It's fascinating to see just how much we're still living with the hangover of the previous administration.
Well, I read something the other day that said the debt interest, the interest on the debt from Ronald Reagan in 2010, we spent $414 billion on, just on the Reagan debt.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, these guys, when they get into office, they don't just damage the country while they're in office and while their policies are, you know, on the books. Even when their policies are taken off the books, it still does enormous scarring to the country for decades to come.
I guess it points to the fact that how simplistic our political discord has become, because all I keep hearing about is Obama ran up $14.3 trillion in debt.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, you know, if you run the numbers from the Congressional Budget Office, they do a, you start off with looking at 2001. You know, in 2001, they forecasted a 2011 deficit. It was actually a surplus of over $800 billion. Remember those days when we had surpluses? That was great.
Yeah, I remember when Alan Greenspan was fretting over how we were going to spend all this money and what would the country do with no debt.
I know, he was so worried about it. It would be silly if it wasn't just really, really depressing. So the Congressional Budget Office in 2001, they made this estimate, and then every single year, actually three times a year, they do revisions on that estimate of the, you know, 2011 deficit, and they tell you exactly why their revisions changed. So you can add up all of the different factors and all of the legislative changes that happened while President Bush was in office are contributing now to 42% of our current deficit. President Obama's policies have only contributed 26% to the current year deficit. That's the $1.4 trillion deficit that we're facing right now. The economic downturn, a little over a fifth, and the financial rescues actually has been a little over 1%. So it's actually been a small amount. But, I'll just say it again. Like, I don't want to sound like I'm Bush bashing at all, but, like, I think that we should give credit where credit is due, and the last president really deserves a huge amount of credit for just running up the nation's credit card.
Yeah, and causing a major crisis that the Republicans had an excuse to cut Social Security and Medicare. See, it's a beautiful plan. Last question I've got for you. You know, this whole debt ceiling thing is going to be in the news for the next couple of weeks. Where do you see this going? I mean, do you really think the Republicans are going to dig their heels in deep and really threaten a shutdown?
I think that they will try to. I mean, Boehner's kind of playing good cop to the Tea Party bad cop, and he is, you know, able to say, well, I would like to do this, but I can't do this, because, you know, they won't vote for it. So he's actually in both a very dangerous situation for him, but also from a negotiating standpoint, an interesting situation where he can actually use the Tea Party to his advantage by making the excuse that he can't get the votes unless he seeks further cuts than he'd even like. So I'll tell you where this is going to end up. And this is my guess, is that what they're going to try to do is put on some sort of spending cap, similar to what Claire McCaskill and Bob Corker, that's a Democrat from Missouri and a Republican from Tennessee, have proposed. They proposed capping outlays at 21%, which is the average from 1970 to 2008. And it's completely inappropriate for today's economy because you've got rising healthcare costs, you've got an aging population, you know, homeland security costs, you know, veterans costs, like all those things that we didn't have before. But that said, I think that they are going to try to push for something. It's not going to be any particular cuts. You're not going to really know what's underneath the hood, but it will probably be a very stringent spending cap. And over time, that will be more and more difficult to stay under. And if that is not continuously waived, and it's supposed to be, you know, they're going to make it so it's very difficult to waive it, that will mean a huge, huge reductions in, you know, completely dismantling a lot of what government does now in terms of keeping the middle class strong, in terms of taking care of the most vulnerable, in terms of investing in the future. And you know, all of these progressive priorities that we've been pushing for decades would really be under assault. So like right now, the name of the game is really trying to make sure that that spending cap does not get attached to the debt limit rate increase.
So basically they want to handcuff us just like they've done to the states so that we're incapable of rising to any emergency or any other crisis. Good. Sounds like sound policy. Ethan Pollack, Senior Policy Analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, EPI.org. I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Our workers' comp system is a confusing maze of rules, delays, and loopholes, where workers struggle to collect what they are owed. Bills don't get paid, and families struggle to put food on the table after a serious work injury. What happens when you're injured on the job in Pennsylvania? Most people think you just apply for workers' comp, and you'll get paid for lost time, and your medical bills will be covered. Sadly, in Pennsylvania, that is not the case. The good news is, it doesn't have to be that way. Hi, I'm Ron Calhoun, and I'm a Central Pennsylvania workers' compensation attorney. It's my job to make sure injured workers receive the benefits they deserve. In the last 20 years, I have helped hundreds of Pennsylvania workers and their families after they've suffered from a work injury. If you've been injured on the job, I'd like the chance to show you how I might be able to do the same for you. Why not find out what you are rightfully owed? Call me at 717-695-4722. You have nothing to lose and much to gain. Call me at 695-4722.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
Taxes, the poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again, because God is a Republican.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Interesting story out of Washington State. The Spokesman Review reported Friday that the lawmakers in Idaho rushed through a bill that would pay $100,000 of taxpayer money to the Idaho Republican Party. Did I mention that 81% of the state's lawmakers are Republicans? Did I mention that? I think it's the best summed up portion of this comes from Senator Elliot Work, a Democrat from Boise, who said, "I have to point out we're paying $100,000 for the Republican Party to sue the Republican legislature, defended by the Republican Secretary of State, in order to close primaries in Idaho." He says, "I just think it's so bad. It's comical." Now, as I understand this, the state of Idaho has never had closed primaries. Here in Pennsylvania, we have closed primaries. You have to say you're a Republican, you vote for the Republican candidates. You have to say you're a Democrat, you vote for the Democratic candidates. Shame on you if you're an independent, you can't vote. So now, I guess this is going to be the first time you have to declare your affiliation. And I got to be honest, it's kind of a nice scam they got going that really I think only a Republican could dream up. Honestly, Democrats aren't this smart. They're not. If I sue myself, and have taxpayers pay me, I win, no matter what, right? You gotta love that. Or as Charlie Sheen would say, winning! Duh! Amazing. I mean, you know, there's no depth too deep for these Republicans to sink. Nothing too deep. Here's another good one. You're gonna love this too. The Associated Press reported, top donor of Governor Scott Walker's gubernatorial campaign, has been charged with multiple violations of campaign finance law, which is kind of laughable because, you know, in states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, there are very few laws. Anyway, prosecutors charged William Gardner, the CEO of Wisconsin and Southern Railroad Company, with one count of excessive political donations and another related to unlawful political contributions. Turns out Mr. Gardner was using his employees and some family members to funnel about $44,000 to Scott Walker during the Republican primaries. Then he illegally reimbursed the donors with company money. He used the company money to reimburse the donors. Walker has since returned the contributions. Notably, the donations were only illegal because the law prohibits direct donations from corporations to candidates. Now, this takes us back to Citizens United. Had they just funneled this money through the GOP hit squad at the Chamber of Commerce, or one of the Koch brothers' euphemistically named front groups, had they just funneled the money that way, no problem. No crime, no foul, no nothing. But this dolt figured, hey, well, I'll just reimburse my friends right out of the company check. Now, here's the thing. He's going to get a slap on the wrist. Rest assured. He'll get a little slap on the wrist, just a little touch, like you would do to a two-year-old, just a little touch, get their attention. And he'll know better next time. So, again, you know, good for them. Good for them. Agency France Press had an interesting article today. Growth in military spending slowed, and it's at its lowest level since 2001. This is the last year as the world economic crisis hit defense budgets, according to this Swedish think tank. Here's the thing. World military spending only rose by 1.3%, very small, up to $1.63 trillion. We're spending, well, over $1.5 trillion to blow ourselves up and to kill ourselves. The average annual growth between 2001, 2009, and us wanting to blow everybody up, about 5.1%, according to this research group. We in the U.S. have spent, just in 2010, almost $700 billion. And between 2001 and 2009, an average growth of 7.4%. So we've been growing the size, growing. Despite the slowdown in the global trend towards buying things to blow ourselves up and kill other people, the U.S. spending increase of $19.6 billion is still accounting for nearly all of the $20.6 billion global increase. So we spent $19.6 billion more, and everybody else spent $1 billion more. Think about that. Sam Perillo, head of SIPRI's Military Expenditure Project, they're the think tank, said in the statement the U.S. has increased its military spending by 81% since 2001. And we wonder why we're running huge, massive deficits. We wonder why we're in the hole when we've handed out trillions of dollars to the top 1%, and now we're handing out billions of dollars to blow people up. And we're talking about cutting $1 billion to education here in the state of Pennsylvania. Absolute insanity. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Susan Grabowski, edvoters.org, back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Corporate America is back. The recession is over. Corporate profits rose by 47% last year, and those giants are now awash in cash, having some $2 trillion stashed in their vaults. So at last, the directors of corporate America are declaring that it's time for long-suffering employees to see their paychecks catch up to pre-recession levels. Great, huh? Oh, I hope you didn't think they meant your paycheck. No, no, bucko. It's the CEOs the directors are concerned about. While plain old workers did receive a 2% boost in their wages in the past year, practically every penny of this tiny increase was gobbled up by inflation. But top executives did much, much better, enjoying a median pay hike of 27% more than they got the previous year. This adds up to a nice round number of $9 million in pay for each of them. Of course, many did far better than that mid-level number. The barista-in-chief at Starbucks, for example, poured $21 million into his cup. The big cheese at Disney, Inc. snapped up $28 million for his year at the helm of the Mickey Mouse Empire. Black & Decker's top tool got $32 million. But the biggest haul of all was made by the honcho of the media giant Viacom. He reeled in $84 million. Yes, I know they point to that 47% rise in overall profit levels as the reason these soaring paychecks are warranted, but take a closer peek at that number. The profit performance is mostly due to eliminating the jobs of thousands of workers last year and downsizing the hours and wages of others. Real profit, derived from increased sales, edged up by only 7%. This is Jim Hightower saying, how's that for shared sacrifice in hard times? Workers get offed, which artificially inflates the bottom line of the corporations, letting CEOs cash in on middle-class misery. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
School may not be out, but it appears SB1 made it out of the Appropriations Committee, and we knew it would. So now the fun begins, and this is why I've been saying everybody should have been calling their senator, telling them, one, now's not the time to start another unaccountable bureaucracy. Two, now's not the time to spend another $1 billion you claim we don't have, especially when our governor corporate has proposed cutting $1 billion from K through 12 and 56% from higher education in his budget. And three, it's just another handout to corporate America that we just can't afford. Sorry, just can't afford it. Maybe when the economy turns around, maybe we can fill their coffers later. Anyway, here to help us walk through this a little bit, Susan Grabeski. She's Executive Director of Education Voters of Pennsylvania. EducationVotersPA.org is the website. Susan, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm
thanks
good.
For having me on.
I appreciate it. Walk me through this. To me, this reminds me of when I was a kid in Cleveland going through the whole busing thing. It just seems like another insane turn away from doing what we have to do, and that's fix public schools.
Well, I think that's right. I think that vouchers is snake oil. Is what we've started to talk about it because that's what it is. You know, the reality is that people keep looking for some other answer besides hard work and resources, and that's what it's going to take to fix schools. And we really need the political will to do it. And now they come along with their magic potion, and they think that they can start diverting money away from public education. The reality is that 90-95% of kids are going to stay behind in the schools that they're talking about helping some kids escape from. And they'll be left with fewer resources. You know, they say, well, it's not the schools that need money, but we're not talking about the schools. Buildings don't need money, but kids do need money.
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent frame, that it's snake oil, because, you know, the more I've been looking at it, the more this is just another soundbite political fix that once they pass it, they'll pat themselves on the back and say, oh, we did some historic stuff, and in 5-6 years down the road, we'll realize that our public schools are crumbling even further. The ones that have been failing will fail even worse, and will have spent a bunch of money giving to private interests with nothing to show for.
And then they'll say, "See, we told you public schools aren't working."
Yeah, right? But the thing is, neither are these charter schools. I mean, they're not lighting the world on fire. In fact, I just read something the other day that the PA cyber charter is one of the worst setups in the country.
Yeah. Well. Right. I mean, I think that the issue is that if we keep underfunding schools and then pointing at them and saying, why aren't they doing the job? You know, I mean, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And the reality is that what the legislature really needs to do is get much more serious and much more targeted about what it actually takes to make the system work properly, to make schools work properly, to make sure that every child gets a genuine opportunity to learn. And that includes looking at what's working. What are the successful schools doing? What are the best schools in the state actually? What do they provide in terms of arts and music and instruction and class size? And, you know, teacher experience, what do they have going for them? What are the challenges that some of the schools that they're talking about targeting face? You know, what are their building? What are their safety issues? What are their curriculum issues? What do they need to actually get going? Because you can turn around a school. Every kid can learn. You know, we know that to be true. So it's not the kids that are the problem. It's whether or not the adults are rising to the challenge.
Excellent point. You know, the thing that gets me is we're not going to fix education by pulling money out of it and giving it somewhere else. We're not going to fix it by underfunding. We're not going to fix it by demonizing teachers. We're just not. We're not going to fix it by attacking teachers' pay and their benefits, because you're going to get good people who are going to leave and not want to put up with that nonsense.
Right. Actually, you know, the best one of the issues these days with the global economy, we look not just, you know, how does Lower Merion compare to Philadelphia, compare to Pittsburgh, or even compare to Cleveland or Cleveland Heights? You know, what we have to look at is how do we compare to Finland and Hong Kong? And one of the things we know is that the best countries in the world actually really revere their teachers. You know, they really treat the profession with dignity and respect, and they recruit and they train and they develop and they give professionals the time and the support that they need to do their job. You know, it's certainly always important to have accountability, but you know, good systems do, right? You know, they say, you know, we want people to come to this profession and be developed into it and be good at their job.
What, browbeaten teachers don't perform well?
I know, it's crazy.
You would think if you whipped them enough, they would get in the shape.
I heard that.
No, you didn't.
They run away and go to their yacht.
Oh, that's it, with their Cadillac health care and their golden parachute pensions. Yeah, you're right. But let's talk about how would you fix this? Because I'm looking at this, and I don't think another bureaucracy, an unaccountable bureaucracy who's going to hand out these lottery tickets, I don't think that's the answer. I don't think spending more money cutting from one area and giving to another area is the answer. I just don't see it. That's the answer. So what is?
Look, I think the thing with vouchers to recognize is that there's you know, a couple of forces coming together. So there's some people, I think, who are very sincere, who are very frustrated with the fact that schools, people keep saying, you know, hey, let's just see what happens and let the schools fix themselves and da-da-da-da-da. So, you know, there are real challenges going on in places that are affecting real people, and it's absolutely true. We just can't wait any longer. And then there are these forces that, you know, have a much more ideological, anti-public education bent, and I think that, you know, they've really sort of picked up this sincere frustration and are really exploiting it to try and push something over the goal line that really doesn't belong there. What it really takes, you know, what we need to do, like I said, is really sit down and look at what is a good education? What does it cost? What do we need in terms of class size? What do we need in terms of early education? One of the things we know is that early education is incredibly effective. One of the things that got cut in Governor Corbett's proposal to cut education spending is they folded in something called accountability block grants, and one of the spending ways that accountability block grants, ABGs, is the ability to provide funding for schools to fund early education and full-day kindergarten. Full-day kindergarten, it seems like a, you know, no-brainer, pun intended, I guess. And yet we're going to start cutting back on full-day kindergarten instead of going forward, even though we know for sure that it works. They say that for every dollar spent on early education, we get $7 to $16 in return from things like reduction of services needed, reduction of crime costs, reduction of remediation, you know, keeping kids on track. And then as you start really getting into, you know, when people start entering the workforce, better educated, better prepared, there's a few things that happen. We attract jobs to the region. We have a much more skilled workforce. People, you know, productivity, as we know, when you have people who feel good about their work and who, you know, are connected to what's going on and to their community, it actually becomes a rising tide. So education is actually some of the best money we can spend. And furthermore, it's the only constitutionally mandated service in Pennsylvania. The Constitution says we have an obligation to provide a thorough and efficient education. It's the only thing. Arguably, it's our very first priority.
Well, that isn't in their Constitution. They didn't read that part. It's not important.
Yeah, you know.
So answer me this. And, you know, this is one of these things that, you know, kind of gets me wondering, you know, in looking at the situation that we're seeing, you know, I've been a firm believer in You've got to engage the parents. You've got to engage the home. Because where I grew up, and I grew up in a really crummy neighborhood with some would argue, you know, failing schools. What I saw, you didn't have the push from home. I think you have to engage that. And I'm not hearing any talk about that. I think weekend programs work. I think that's part of it. And as you pointed out, giving kids the advantage of pre-K and full day kindergarten.
Right. So there's a few things that are going on, right? And so one is we need early education. We need to work with programs that work, things like after school tutoring. There's actually a great movement called Communities and Schools, and it's really thinking about how we can do more to make sure that schools are really connected to the communities. How do we get more people into parents, community members into the building? How do we get the schools out on the community level? That's a key place that we need to look at. But I think the other thing that I really, parental involvement is important, and we know that it can help turn around a variety of factors, but we also know that a school needs to provide a quality education to every kid regardless of whether or not their parent is involved. We can't have a system that says, well, you know, if the parents aren't going to do it, what do you want us to do? Our job is to walk in the door and make sure that every kid has a high-quality opportunity. That should be non-negotiable. And I get really frustrated with legislators who say, well, it's the parents. You know, and there are 254 people who can make state policy and allocate resources in this state, and what I say is that they need to be accountable for the part. Their part is to make sure that we are providing a high-quality opportunity for every single child, not based on whether or not their parents are involved, but based on whether or not we have they walk in the door of a safe building with quality resources and sufficient resources.
So this bill just got out of the Appropriations Committee. It's going to hit the Senate floor. What should people do to stop this?
Well, one of the things they need to do is call their senator, like, tomorrow morning. You know, it's first of all, it's unbelievably unaffordable. You know, experts are saying it could cost $800 million to $1 billion in 3 to 4 years. They've actually started to try and put out a different number to try and make it seem less expensive, but the number that they're putting out is the same number that we've been fighting over for the past 2 or 3 years. If we could actually keep on pace with $350 to $500 million, if we could actually restore some of the proposed cuts, we could actually continue to improve education for every kid, not just a handful. This bill lacks accountability. When you start giving that money in vouchers, it goes to private schools who, by their very nature, are opting out of things like standards. You know, they may have good standards, they may not, but we don't know. They may have great finances, they may not, but we won't know, and we won't have any right to know. It's going to be a huge giveaway to subsidize private schools, you know, and I'm sure some good things will happen, but that doesn't mean that, you know, by and large, we have any assurance. It means in many cases that kids are going to be able to, and they will, use vouchers to go to schools that are performing at a lower level than the schools that they're performing now. It's not going to only go to kids who are in those schools, but, in fact, over the next couple of years, they'll phase in the ability to give it to any kid, even kids that are not currently in those schools.
Right. So you got to call your senator. You got to get on the phone. Let them know that you are against SB1.
Right.
Susan Gabreski, I appreciate your time. Educationvoterspa.org is the website. There's a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Rick. And tell your viewers, remind them again later to make that call.
I will do. We're going to take a quick break right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
The Washington State Capitol building in Olympia was buzzing last week with raucous protests. Chants that filled the Marble Building's rotunda echoed those heard in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and more. In a move similar to Wisconsin, the Capitol was even occupied overnight by protesters wanting their voices to be heard in the morning sessions. The issues at stake in Washington mostly revolve around budget proposals by both Republicans and Democrats that would see social services and education funding slashed without any tax breaks or loopholes being addressed. Democrats hold a slight majority in both houses of the legislature, but due to a referendum passed in November, no taxes can be raised in the state without a two-thirds majority. That means the only way to balance the budget in the state without such a majority is by making drastic cuts. Some of the tax breaks protesters have recommended the legislature cut include incentives for filmmaking in the state and plastic surgery. Healthcare workers in the state went on strike Thursday to have their voices heard in the Capitol, even disrupting the House session to the point where they were asked to leave the gallery. Maureen Masterson is a clinician with Compass Health.
To deny seniors the right to remain in their homes with adequate trained care.
Right.
It deprives people who are residents and citizens of this state the right to have medical treatment and medication that they need. That's not a budget. That is immoral. Shame on you.
Shame on you!
Even as teacher unions are under unprecedented attacks to strip their union rights, the American Federation of Teachers is making significant gains organizing charter schools in Chicago. Doug Cunningham files this report.
Chicago has 85 charter schools. The AFT so far has organized 12 of them and intends to unionize them all. The Chicago Alliance of Charter Teachers and Staff is a united effort by the Chicago Teachers Union and the State and National American Federation of Teachers. The growing charter school movement often scapegoats teacher unions and diverts funds away from public education. Nationwide right now, more than 600 charter schools are unionized, but that's a small percentage of the total number of charter schools. The latest charter school to see teachers forming a union in Chicago is the Chicago Math and Science Academy, but so far the administration there is refusing to recognize the teachers' union. Even as the AFT organizes more charter schools, the administrations of those charter schools in the city, by and large, are still anti-union and are fighting efforts by teachers and staff to get organized voice on the job.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come on, ya good workers, good news to you out there. Around the good old union has come in to thrill. Which side are you on?
Well, the no rights at work agenda, it's being pushed on even those without jobs. The state of Utah is the latest state to join those kicking the unemployed while they're down. And this is what's interesting, the rational of the Republicans in Utah who cut unemployment insurance are saying it's insane. The irrational are saying, well, it's motivation to get people back to work. In fact, Senate President Michael Waltrip, a Republican from Taylorsville, Utah, said it's tax money and people need to be weaned off the government for paying for everything. Refusing to continue to extend unemployment benefits is a motivation for people to go back to work. And we've been seeing this across the country as a result of these Republican-dominated legislatures. Now in Utah, 20,000 people are going to lose their unemployment. And the thing is unemployment isn't, there's no glory there. About $290 a week is the national average. Not exactly living high off the hog, which is why I find it interesting that recent research by the San Francisco Federal Reserve has found that people who get unemployment benefits, they generally stay unemployed about a week and a half longer than people who don't qualify for unemployment benefits. So I'm not seeing the argument. But the question is, who stands up for the workers? It's their unions. And that's why you're seeing an all-out assault on workers' rights across this country and right here in Pennsylvania. You'll remember last week we spent considerable time talking about the radical right-wing no rights at work agenda. Well, while we were talking about it, our friends at the Teamsters were planning to do something about it, and today they held their rally and lobbying day where nearly 1,000 Teamsters and people who believe in having rights at work took to the Capitol and voiced their outrage. We're here to talk about that is our good friend Kevin Cicek. He's recording secretary and business agent with Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be here. Jake, how you doing?
Congratulations on the great turnout.
We had an outstanding turnout today. I mean, the weather cooperated. People came out from all over the state. We got a great hookup with a couple other unions. It worked out really well.
So what was, tell us what, for those who weren't there, what was the theme?
Well, absolutely positively, the theme was that we wanted to make sure that Republicans understand that we're not going to sit still for this attack on workers' rights. We're hoping that there's enough moderate Republicans available that are going to help us out here on this issue.
And what are you seeing? You did a little bit of lobbying today. What kind of response did you get?
Well, as expected, there are a lot of Republicans who are a little nervous about what Metcalf had in store. He's done a great job, trying to fancy this thing up. You know, he doesn't call it right to work. He's calling it this, workplace initiative, and it's going to be great for workers, and it's really going to be great. It's going to take us into the next, 10 years stronger, and it's going to create new jobs in this country. And it's all a bag of beans, and some of the Republicans are starting to figure it out. And some of the Democrats are doing a great job. Mike Sterl has put out some really good information that we were using today to educate some of our Republican friends and try to make them understand why this is something we just don't want to do in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I went to his press conference, which was really kind of interesting on so many levels. It was interesting. And, they just kind of got this, all the good stuff that's going to, this guy just cracks me up. President of Carlisle Electric, John Mama. he had really an interesting thing to say, which is all the good things are going to come. All the good stuff that we want, it's going to be there, all the good stuff. And you go, well, what are you talking about? No, it's just all the good stuff, none of the bad stuff. And you had Jack Zimmer, the guy from the ABC, saying, you've never seen an economic boom in a right-to-work state. amazing stuff. Yeah.
Well, it's incredible about, the emperor has no clothes issue because they want to talk about it's going to create jobs. What it's all about is they want the right to just say how it's going to be. And it's going to be take it or leave it. It's not going to be take it or leave it, join the union. It's going to be take it or leave it. You do it the way we tell you you're going to do it or get out because you're back to an at-will status and you're gone for whatever reason or no reason.
And that's the thing I think working people in this state and really across the country need to understand. All of the protections that you see are because someone fought, bled, and died for it. And I guess I have to blame you guys for this. I blame you guys for doing too good of a job in protecting workers to where they think basically they don't need you anymore.
Well, Rick, you and I have talked before. I think a lot of people in the labor movement have thought that, we were going to have to suffer as a movement. We were going to have to suffer as a people before things were going to get better again. And quite frankly, I didn't think I'd see it, in my career or maybe even in my lifetime. But we're seeing it right now. We are suffering. The middle class is getting squeezed from both ends. And, the time's now. And, I talked to Frank Snyder from the AFL-CIO today about, there's great challenges here, but there's also great opportunities. We're stronger in the labor movement now than we've been, I think, in my entire career in the movement. We're seeing the great activism now starting to come back with the students are beginning to realize their eyes are opening up to what's going on. And I think we got some great opportunities to build some coalitions and really be able to be in a position to get some things done here in the near future.
So what do you say to, I've asked this of a couple of people. What do you say to the person who's probably never going to be a union member, knows nothing about unions? They just hear this nice flowery language like, oh, you have the right to work. Not really understanding what that means in law. What do you say to that person?
Well, every one of those people, and I talk to them all the time, they know somebody who didn't do anything wrong in a job, but for whatever reason was let go. So they understand what at will is. They understand those problems. And when we talk about, the union levels the playing field, not just for union members, but for everybody. In the states where unions are strong, everyone's doing better. I mean, that's traditionally how it's been. We go through the litany of we have overtime because of unions. We have weekends because of unions. We have health care because of unions. We have pensions because of unions. And you may have never been in a union, but you have those things because somebody in the labor movement fought for it in the past and got it for all of us. And as the labor movement has come under attack, those people are beginning to see their things that they've enjoyed that we've gotten for them. They're starting to erode. Their pensions are going down. They realize what the 401k mess created for them, and they don't have a pension. They're beginning to wake up as well, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And later on in the program, we're talking with Roland Zullo. He's a researcher at the University of Michigan. Their research on labor, employment, and the economy. He found that in right-to-work states, in the construction industry, they had a higher fatality rate. They had an higher injury rate. And when we talk to him, he's going to talk a little bit more about his study. But it does bring that question up. There are a number of benefits to being a state that has rights on the job.
Well, that goes along with what your friend Mumma was saying from Carlisle. All the good things that are going to come with it. His ability to cut a corner, do things cheaper, which aren't necessarily safer. And there's nobody there. There's no business agent. There's no steward. There's no member who has a contract to back him up who's going to say, well, wait, time out. You're not doing this the right way. My safety's at risk. In a right-to-work situation, hey, too bad. If you don't like it, get out.
Yeah, there's the door. And that's the thing I think people need to get, that this is for everybody. These are protections for everyone.
Absolutely. I think we need, just as we tried to educate Republicans on why it's important and what they need to be focused on here, we need to do that in the public. You know, our president at Local 776, Bob Snyder, brought a great message to Harrisburg today, which is we're not giving money to politicians anymore. We're not doing it. We're not going to hand over a check and hope you do the right thing. We're going to use that money to mobilize our members to go work for people who are our friends and who take care of us, and we're going to go work against those folks who turn their backs on us.
That's something I've been calling for years now, and good on him for doing it. Let me ask you this. You know, going down the road, this was the first of what I'm assuming will be a number of actions. Where are you going from here?
Well, we understand that the college students are again planning a Rock the Capitol event in 2 weeks, and we're planning on partnering with them. We think, you know, they have a great message going on. It's a damn shame what the governor's trying to do with education in this state, and we want to partner with those folks. You know, they're going to be the workforce of the future, and we want to make sure that they understand that in their time of need, we were there to help them, just as they've come around now. Some of those college students were at our rally today. So we're going to want to partner with them on that. We're going to look for those kind of opportunities. And we're going to continue to build the coalitions. You know, we had a great turnout today from the nurses. Their registered staff nurses they happened to have their statewide conference at the Hilton today in Harrisburg. And they took time out of their schedule, and they marched up down to the Capitol to join our rally. Well, Bob Snyder and I went to see their leadership afterwards later this afternoon to talk to them about how, you know, we haven't worked together in the past, but we've got to remember we're all in this together now, and we're getting tighter, and that coalition is coming together the way it should be.
Well, it's like the rallies that they had on April 4th. We are one. I think the attacks by people like Walker and Kasich and our Governor Corporate here have pulled people together and healed some of those fractures that have been in the labor movement for too long.
Absolutely. I think it's just like in your family. You can fight with your brothers or your sisters, but when somebody else comes along and tries to bully somebody, we all get together. That's what we're doing in labor, and that's the way it needs to be.
Last question I've got for you. You know, one of the things that I've been thinking through is we need to go have local actions at each of the district offices of the people who put their names on this No Rights at Work agenda, and going back and saying, look, and Frank Snyder's the guy who came up with this, ask for our money back. We don't want your representation. We don't need it. We want our money back, just like you're trying to do. But if we're getting trouble, you have to represent us anyway.
I think it's a great point that Frank makes. You know, I may not have a car, but I get to pay highway tax. I may not have a child in school, but I get to pay school tax. Somewhere along the line in our republic, we decided, you know what? We're going to take care of the common good. Well, that's what we do in the workplace. That's what a union does. We take care of the common good at the work site, and somebody who's benefiting from what the union is doing ought to help pay for that. If they don't want to be a member, that's fine. They want to opt out, that's fine. But they should pay their fair share just as they do now.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I got to be honest with you. I wasn't in favor of Iraq, so I don't think I should have to pay for that. But good luck getting out of that.
And you'd have a big chunk of change coming back for that.
Absolutely. Kevin Cicek, I appreciate your time. Great job today, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for all your help.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
A brand new world economy. I don't believe them. I won't. uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Corporate America is back. The recession is over. Corporate profits rose by 47% last year, and those giants are now awash in cash, having some $2 trillion stashed in their vaults. So at last, the directors of corporate America are declaring that it's time for long-suffering employees to see their paychecks catch up to pre-recession levels. Great, huh? Oh, I hope you didn't think they meant your paycheck. No, no, bucko. It's the CEOs the directors are concerned about. While plain old workers did receive a 2% boost in their wages in the past year, practically every penny of this tiny increase was gobbled up by inflation. But top executives did much, much better, enjoying a median pay hike of 27% more than they got the previous year. This adds up to a nice round number of $9 million in pay for each of them. Of course, many did far better than that mid-level number. The barista-in-chief at Starbucks, for example, poured $21 million into his cup. The big cheese at Disney, Inc. snapped up $28 million for his year at the helm of the Mickey Mouse Empire. Black & Decker's top tool got $32 million. But the biggest haul of all was made by the honcho of the media giant Viacom. He reeled in $84 million. Yes, I know they point to that 47% rise in overall profit levels as the reason these soaring paychecks are warranted, but take a closer peek at that number. The profit performance is mostly due to eliminating the jobs of thousands of workers last year and downsizing the hours and wages of others. Real profit, derived from increased sales, edged up by only 7%. This is Jim Hightower saying, how's that for shared sacrifice in hard times? Workers get offed, which artificially inflates the bottom line of the corporations, letting CEOs cash in on middle-class misery.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Standing tall against the multinational corporate agenda, The Rick Smith Show.
I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, there was a day where maybe the Employee Free Choice Act was possible. I don't know now. Anyway, Virginia's looking pretty interesting. Because it looks like we're going back to the good old days. The radical right's not all that thrilled with Senator George Macaca Allen, especially after his latest racially questionable sports observation. So the radical right is looking elsewhere in the 2012 Virginia senatorial race. So what do you have? You have instep T. Twizzler, Jamie Radke. She has positioned herself as really the ultra-right-wing alternative to Macaca Allen. This past weekend, she was at the Awakening 2011. Basically, it's Extremapalooza. It was at Liberty University, and Think Progress was there, and they asked her about the role of the minimum wage in the country, and like a good corporate tool, she argued that government setting price controls rather than letting the free market set it, I think, is bad policy. She went on to contend that the time has come and gone when women were underpaid, employers were taking advantage of employees, and concern about factory conditions was justified. As a result, Radke agreed that the minimum wage has outlived its usefulness. So according to her, if I'm getting this right, women are being paid equal to men. Employers never exploit their workforce or never treat them poorly. The minimum wage is counterproductive because, in her words, there are times when the market will demand more than what minimum wage should be, and then people are being underpaid. So basically, her argument is if there's a minimum wage, no employer will pay over the minimum wage. There's no option for them to pay more to attract qualified people. None at all. I wonder what her response would be if we had no minimum wage and employers were paying a dollar I wonder what her response would be then. And of course, to this argument that, you know, employers never, oh, they never mistreat their workers. I point to the LA Times piece this past weekend, when they're talking about IKEA, the big home furnishings giant, who selected Danville, Virginia, what they're saying is a fraying blue-collar city, to build its first U.S. factory. They say residents couldn't believe their good fortune. Beloved by consumers worldwide for its stylish and affordable furniture, the Swedish firm had also constructed a reputation as a good employer and solid corporate citizen. Now, state and local people kicked in about $12 million in incentives to lure IKEA there. And the residents were thrilled. Going to have some jobs. This foreign company is going to bring some jobs. This formal textile industry area is going to see maybe a little boost. Now they say after 3 years, the massive facility is turned into not a very happy place. There are racial discrimination claims. There are claims that disgruntled employees are leaving, and now you've got a union organizing campaign. And I ask you, why do people join unions? We go back to wages, hours, conditions. Wages, hours, and conditions. So the article goes on, and here it is. Workers complain of eliminated raises, wages, a frenzied pace, conditions, and mandatory overtime, wages, hours, conditions. Several said it's common to find out on Friday evening that they'll have to pull a weekend shift and with disciplinary action if they can't or don't show up. So what you have is you have people who have to cancel doctor's appointments. You have all of these problems that go along trying to find daycare because you have an industry or company that basically wants you at their beck and call. So the 335 workers at this plant said, you know what, we'd like a union. They contacted the machinists union and signed cards. You got a majority of people signing cards. The people said they want representation. So what's the company do? Well, what the majority of them do. They hire an anti-union firm, and none bigger or more costly than Jackson Lewis. Now the workers get to attend captive meetings. They get to endure threats and intimidation, retaliation, and even firings. What I find interesting about this particular case is that Sweden, as a country, has a unionized workforce of almost 80%. So almost 80% of their workforce is unionized. The LA Times called Danville, Virginia, this plant here in Danville, Virginia, a place where no one would return a call. Their spokesperson for the company, in Sweden, mind you, her name was Ingrid Steen. I love that name, Ingrid. She called the situation sad, and that she'd heard rumors about anti-union meetings at the plant, and added that that wouldn't be anything that would be approved by the group management in Sweden. And I love this part. This is the great part. And it's not surprising. It's not surprising at all. But the dust-up has garnered little attention in the U.S., according to the L.A. Times. But it's front-page news in Sweden, where much of the labor force is unionized, and IKEA is a cherished institution. That guy who's the head of the Swedish union, I'm not going to butcher his name, he said he was baffled by the friction going on in Danville, Virginia, pointing out that IKEA has a code of conduct known as I-Way, which guarantees workers the right to organize, and it stipulates that all overtime is voluntary. He goes on to say IKEA is a very strong brand, and they lean on some kind of good Swedishness in their business profile. That becomes a complication when they act like they do in the United States, and it's a huge problem for us. Here comes the eye-opener, and this is where our American workers need to listen up. Laborers in Swedewood, which is the name of the big company, Swedewood plants in Sweden produce bookcases and tables similar to those manufactured in Danville. The big difference is that the Europeans enjoy a minimum wage of about $19 an hour, and a government-mandated 5 weeks of paid vacation. Now, let's come to the U.S., where a full-time worker in the Danville plant starts at $8 an hour with 12 days vacation, eight of them determined by the company. Get that? $19 an hour over there, $8 here. What's more, as many as one-third of the workers at the Danville plant have been drawn from temporary local staffing agencies. And they receive even lower wages with no benefits. Don't you find that distressing? That, I know I do. And this guy, Bill Street, he's one of the organizers of the plant, and we're going to try and get him this week to talk about this. It's amazing. But he points out that IKEA is just taking advantage of our screwy laws and the weak protections afforded to workers in this country. He says, quote, "It's ironic that IKEA looks to the U.S. and Danville the way most people in the U.S. look at Mexico." And this is exactly what I've been saying for some time. Last week we talked about this with the Germans, how when some of the German plants came over here, the Germans are going, "Hey, you're stealing our jobs." And you look at it, and it's true. Now, this company made 2.7 billion euros in profit last year. 2.7 billion euros last year. You're going to love this. This is good. It's going to blow your mind. And you got to love her honesty. Our good friend Ingrid said that the company spokeswoman said that the changes were made from $9.75 an hour to start down to $8 an hour to free up more money for pay incentive bonuses. Yeah, we need more pay incentive bonuses. So we dropped their wages. Paul Breyer, he's written a piece on this. He writes, "What's more perplexing is that while busting unions and paying workers low wages, IKEA is owned by one of the world's richest charity organizations." And he goes through and he points out the fact that SIF, which is this big charity foundation in Sweden, their mission is dedication to innovation in the field of architectural and interior design. So that's their mission. They have $36 billion in 2006. Think bigger than the Bill Gates Foundation. And these are the kind of companies that are coming here, are good at home, but boy, when they come here, man, they act very American. Very American.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Rick, but in Sweden, they have one of the world's highest standard of living. Why? Because they have very strong unions. I believe you mentioned over 80% of their workforce.
Almost 80%.
You can bet that that's a major, major reason. And they've been there for decades, by the way. It's not just the last couple of years, but they've had one of the world's highest standards of living for decades.
I mean, it's just mind-blowing that we put up with this time and time again, where you see exactly what's going on, and it barely made the newspaper. This story was the L.A. Times reported on. That's it.
But we keep seeing this scenario in company after company after company, and it's not just Scandinavia, it's European companies that come into this country. And in Europe and in Scandinavia, the unions are extremely strong. And when they come here, it's almost as if, Rick, and it is, it's sadly, United States is now a low-wage country. Sadly.
Well, like I've been saying, you know, that great leveling off. As soon as our wages come down to that of the third world, we're gonna see some jobs come back. Or if we can be exploited like other countries. Amazing stuff. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We come back, we're gonna come back with Roland Zulo. He's a researcher at the University of Michigan, their Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy. Back after this.
Executive Director of CAIU on the decision to switch to Capital Blue Cross Health Insurance.
By moving to Capital Blue Cross, we were able to achieve savings that we had never expected. We're getting quality care and tremendous customer service. As both a consumer of healthcare and as the director of this agency, I couldn't be happier that we switched to Capital Blue Cross.
To learn more, call 1-800-976-2242 or visit capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Making the blue blood see red.
The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember to check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, right there you can download our podcast. You know, we've been talking about this this no rights at work agenda that the radical right here in the state of Pennsylvania is attempting to pursue. Darrell Metcalf, the corporate tool that he is, taking us down this path, which, again, I think is destructive for all workers. And I point to this recent piece of work done by Roland Zulo on the construction industry, saying that right-to-work states have a higher fatality rate. Here to talk about that study is Roland Zulo. He is a researcher at the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. Roland, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, Rick. Happy to be here.
We're talking about this here in the state of Pennsylvania. I know in Michigan, they were talking about right-to-work zones. This seems to be, again, something that, states across the country are dealing with. Walk me through your study and tell me a little bit about, what you found.
Well, we were interested in sort of looking at how right-to-work, makes it just more difficult for unions to achieve their major goals. And in the building trades, one of the major goals of the building trades, as it is in many unions, is to protect worker safety. And we see that not only in the safety programs that they have for their own members, but also their advocacy for OSHA standards and good enforcement. So we wanted to see if there was any relationship between the ability for the building trade unions to protect member safety and right to work. So we looked over roughly a 9-year period, and we looked at industry fatalities in construction and compared that in right to work and non-right to work states. And what we found is that in across the board, if you have more unions, you have lower rates of worker fatality. Okay, across all the states.
Well, it goes to say that they've got a voice and a say in what they do.
They have a voice and a say. They also have more resources to devote to training and safety programs. So that's across the board. But we found the effect even greater in non-right-to-work states. So what that meant was if you have many union members in a non-right-to-work state, like Michigan or Pennsylvania, they tend to be far more effective at protecting members against fatalities, if that makes sense.
So yeah, it does.
So the effect is conditional.
Okay.
And it's consistent with this idea that, you know, unions need resources to do what they do. To try to achieve their objectives. And one objective is worker safety. And in right-to-work states, they just don't have the resources to devote to worker safety training like they do in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan.
So in business-friendly states that have these no rights at work clauses, the right to work for less stuff, they have a higher fatality rate. How much higher are we talking?
Well, about between 40 and between 35 and 40% higher.
Wow.
In right to work states. Yeah.
That's considerably higher.
Yeah, it is. It is. And the construction industry is one of the more dangerous industries. I know that, you know, out your way, I know coal mining is a major industry, and of course that's a very risky industry as well. And there are also, you know, out here, auto is a very dominant industry out here, and there's fatalities there as well. But in construction, because of the risks of a fall or electrocution or a vehicle accident, it's one of the highest, most dangerous industries that we have. So
35 to 40%? 35 to 40% higher in right-to-work states.
In a right-to-work state, yeah.
That should, I mean, right there should be one of those things, those light bulbs that go off and go, oh, we don't want to become a right-to-work state.
Well, I don't think policymakers look at this sort of thing when they're trying to decide whether a state should be right-to-work or not. I think they're pushed by political forces to make decisions. And not really looking at the facts. And so we wanted to do this. We wanted to explore this and see if there was anything there. And we were quite surprised by what we found.
That is surprising. Have you done any work on injury rates and on things like that in the industry?
Well, that's the next step. The problem with injury rates is that they're not very reliable. Often injuries go unreported.
Right.
And you know, again, especially if you don't have a union to protect you and you're injured, the risk of you sort of being let go is greater. So a worker on a job in a non-union site who gets injured is probably, we don't know this for sure, but we can hypothesize would probably be less likely to report an injury, right? So in right-to-work states, where you have lower levels of unionization, you might see lower injury rates just simply because of the reporting bias. So we need to look at this. We need to look at injuries, but the measure itself is somewhat problematic to look at. So we focused on fatalities because those have to be reported.
Yeah, you can't fake that.
You can't fake that. So we wanted to look at fatalities, and we chose an industry where safety was really a major concern for the unions involved. And, you know, we looked at all, it was the data we derived this from was all public data. So it's something anybody with the skills can go and download and analyze. You know, there's nothing secret here. We came up with these findings.
So let me ask you this, Roland. You know, which states had the worst records? Do you know that, or is it?
Well, we didn't parse that out. We used a model that controlled for a lot of different factors across the state. So we controlled for the amount of heavy construction, for example, versus specialty construction. We controlled for the productivity, and by the way, productivity does. Unions are, in the building trade, much more associated with higher productivity.
Sure, because they have higher training rates, they have more experience. I mean, right. You know, their apprenticeship programs are second to none.
Yeah, they have great apprenticeship programs. And throughout their skill training, of course, woven into that are lessons about safety. So it sort of, they go hand in hand. And so you tend to have a safer environment. You have better trained workers who know what they're doing when they're on the job, and so you have a higher or more productive and a safer work environment.
And those are all things I think you want in a construction industry.
Well, I think you want that in any industry, right? I mean, I think when you ask the question, how do we become wealthier, right? How do we earn more? How do we achieve better benefits for ourselves? The way to do it is really through higher productivity. And less waste, higher productivity, and of course, you know, any kind of accident, injury, or certainly a fatality imposes a cost on everybody, a cost you really can't measure.
Yeah, I agree with the higher productivity thing. Only I wish that wages had kept up with productivity over the last 30 years.
Well, I wish they have too. And, you know, one of the things that labor unions do is they do what's called productivity bargaining. So they assess productivity, and if productivity goes up, then they, when they're at the bargaining table, they negotiate to get their fair share of that. And so if you have fewer unions, you might get higher productivity, but those gains aren't shared. And so that's what we're seeing more broadly in the economy.
So when will you be doing the next study?
Well, I mean, the next study, we have to take a more refined look, looking at the different cases. You know, we produce research all the time from our institute, and I think this study gave us enough to go forward with a more detailed analysis, looking at injuries or fatalities on a case by case basis. So we'll, you know, in the next 6 months to a year, we'll be moving ahead now with a more comprehensive analysis.
Yeah, because with all of the talk, especially here, with all the talk of making Pennsylvania a right to work state, I think people need to be informed about the realities of doing that. You know, it sounds nice. You know, who could be against the right to work? Until you take the peel off the onion, you realize that it's really a screw job.
Well, here's what I offer to people, because I do talk to folks a lot who don't know what the term really means. They don't know what right to work means, and it is a label that's given a happy sounding name for something which is really very much anti-labor, anti-union, and anti-worker. Period. But here's how I explain it to folks. I use an analogy. I tell them to imagine that they're a mayor of a small town, and that they're responsible for keeping the park clean and keeping the water flowing and keeping the libraries open and all the public services, right?
Okay.
And then as mayor, though, the governor of the state issues a decree saying that from henceforward, all taxes will be voluntary. Okay? So then as mayor now, you're responsible for keeping all the public services open and running, but now the payment of taxes will be voluntary. So that mayor now has to deal with all these, and by the way, if a person in your town doesn't want to pay their taxes, they still get to go to the library, they still get their water that still comes to their house, they can still visit the park, they enjoy all the services, but they don't have to pay a dime toward the cost of those services. So how does it change the way a mayor would operate, or for that matter, how a union would function? Well, you just simply have fewer resources, because there's always going to be some folks who won't pay. And then, of course, you have to spend a lot of your energy and time trying to convince people that they have to pay, right? And this is what happens in right-to-work states.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, I use that, and folks seem to understand, you know, they seem to sort of grasp what I mean, you know, what the implications are for labor if you put it in those terms.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. You know, as we go forward in this, you know, we're going to be talking about this whole right to work for less legislation and moving forward, because we're going to have to fight this back. I can't see Pennsylvania being the 23rd right to work state, judging from all of the negative consequences and all the negative information from other states. And this study that you've put forth, just another one of those in a long line of negative consequences for right to work.
Well, let's hope not. I mean, Pennsylvania is a great state. I, you know, you have such a rich labor history. It would be really a shame to go right to work.
Yeah, I agree. Roland Zolo, I appreciate your time. And when you put out the next study, let me know.
Okay.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made, and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, all Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make this
happen! Your working class radio appearance. Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Work it hard to make a left. Rich and farm red. Father, son, left a cameo. Blue denim, head is vape.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our tweet of the day comes from Senator Vince Hughes, who says, economic crisis not result of working class and poor, but by big business greed. Yet we give them a pass in PA budget. Where is the fairness, he asks. And I agree, where is the fairness? We're giving huge tax handouts to them, to the drillers. We're giving huge tax handouts to corporations. And we're not asking anything in return. We've let them keep their Delaware loophole so they can let all their profits flee out of the state. We haven't taxed the drillers so that they can pocket the tax they're already charging. Good for them. And, you know, I look at this report, this study that the guy that Roland just laid out to us, 34 to 40% higher fatality rates in right-to-work states. And we're talking about building an industry in this state where you're going to need an awful lot of construction workers working on these rigs, on this Marcellus Shale drilling. How many injuries, how many deaths are we going to have moving forward? How's that going to affect the working people of this state and the construction industry going forward if we do what corporate tool Metcalf wants us to do?
Well, one thing we don't talk about, and this is a little bit different than what you just talked about, but the maximum we're going to get from these companies, an extraction tax, is right now when we first started. As years go on and on and on and on, I mean, it's only common sense. It's just like any other well. The level of the well is going to go down, and it's going to be harder and harder and harder to extract it. So right now, they are getting maximum extraction, which would mean if we had adequate taxes, we would get maximum revenue for the people of Pennsylvania. But we're not. We're losing out on what could potentially be, Rick, billions of dollars.
A soon-to-be-released study in talking about the drilling. A soon-to-be-released study by Cornell University is saying that the shale gas produced from the fracking, the hydraulic fracturing, could create as much as twice the greenhouse gas as coal. The professor, Robert Harwath, he argues in the study that making natural gas available through fracking contributes more to global warming than conventional gas and coal over 20 years, stating that natural gas is composed largely of methane, and 3.6 to 7.9% of the methane from shale gas production escapes into the atmosphere in venting and leaks over the lifetime of the well. He goes on to say that these methane emissions are at least 30% more and perhaps more than twice as great as those from conventional gas. The higher emissions from shale gas occur at the time wells are hydraulically fractured as methane escapes from flowback return fluids and during drill out following the fracturing. So basically what we're doing now is what these folks are evidently saying is over the next 20 years, as we keep punching these holes into the ground, we're actually going to be doing much worse for the environment. And these are the kind of things that you should have fleshed out a couple of years ago before we started putting the needles in the ground. These are the kind of things that you should be in front of as opposed to behind of. And this is where we're at. We're behind the eight ball.
And as the problems get worse and worse, we're going to get to the point where we can't realistically tax them at a high enough rate. The damage that they're going to incur as it goes on year after year after year, the damage is going to be increased. One other point, Rick, if you don't think that a lot of this is political philosophy, and I think you touched on it last week on a Friday, some of these companies are saying, look, it's not that big a deal, but they certainly could survive in a system where they knew what the taxation would be because then they can plan their budgets. It can become part of the cost of doing business. It certainly isn't going to put them out of business, and to a large degree, it's not even going to hurt them.
But here's what I'm saying, and it goes kind of what you're saying. The reality is it's in their business plan. You don't go into a state without figuring, okay, the national average for taxation is 7.5% like it is in Texas. Before we even consider going into Pennsylvania and dropping one needle into the ground, we're planning from the beginning that 7.5%. We've already put that in our price. It's already there. It's already part of the price of the commodity that's going global. It's not like that Pennsylvanians are buying this gas. This gas is going global. The tax is already there, which is what's driving me nuts. You're paying it. It's already being paid. It's just that we're not reaping the benefits. And again, it's that redistribution of wealth from the working people of this state, whose resource it is, up to the investor class who, they don't live in this state. That gas leaves. The investors aren't from here. The companies aren't even from here. That's what gets me. We're already paying it. We're just not reaping the benefits.
Well, and look at it from their standpoint. I mean, they don't know when and if there's going to be a tax. Do they have to have a special fund set aside in case all of a sudden, common sense grabs us up in the legislature and you have a governor that's going to sign it? Are we then going to impose a tax and they have to rearrange their plan? And from a business standpoint, it just doesn't make sense. Not to mention you're depriving the taxpayers of Pennsylvania. One thing that I don't understand, Corbett gives you this impression that, well, because they come in here, all of a sudden, it's their oil. No, it's not their oil.
It's their gas.
It's not, you're right. Slip of the tongue here. It's not their gas. The gas is in Pennsylvania. That gas belongs to the people of Pennsylvania. And why shouldn't we share to a maximum level the wealth that it's creating? And we're not. We certainly are not. We're getting shortchanged to a large degree.
Well, we're getting screwed is what we're getting.
Well, you call it what you want. I was trying to be nice.
We are getting what we're getting. And, again, poll after poll shows that, people across the state say, instead of cutting $1 billion in education, there's a revenue stream there. Tap that first. There's a revenue stream leaving the state, the Delaware loophole. Tap that first. And then you go after saying, well, then we may need to cut, then we may need to raise some other resources to save education. And, going back to our conversation with Susan Grabowski, my son, just turned 5. He reads better than my daughter did when she was in first grade because he started much younger. He had more opportunity. And to me, we started our daughter off in a pre-K program. It wasn't as good as the one my son's in now. Wish we would have known better. We would have moved him to the better one. But at the end of it, we have the resources to be able to do that. a good portion of the people in the state don't. And I look at the fact that this privatization of education has failed. What I would like to see, you want to privatize education? Fine. Then you give me the constitutional right to sue those companies for failing to educate the children who fail. You look at this piece, someone sent it to me during the break. It's from Ohio.com. It points out that since 2008, the Akron-based White Hat Management Company has collected around $230 million to run charter schools in Ohio. The company has grown into a national chain and reports that it has 20,000 students across the country, but now 10 of its own schools and the state of Ohio are suing, complaining that many White Hat students are failing and that the company has refused to account for how the money has been spent. I'll tell you how the money's been spent. The guy wearing the white hat has put it in his pocket. All of those kids be damned. So I say, you know what? You want to go this route? Fine. Then we have the right to go after and sue the white hat people or whoever the profiteer is. Let's go get some of that money back. So the kid who falls behind, let's sue so maybe we don't have, the taxpayers don't have to pay for it.
And with the Supreme Court we have now, you can forget it.
I mean, you know, I just saw this the other day. It said that the Pennsylvania cyber charter schools, which we've been are all over the radio ads. Oh yeah, send your kids to cyber charter this or that. One of the worst in the country. And I'm going, you know, this idea that we need to keep reinventing the wheel is ridiculous.
And here's where this right-wing noise machine, I hear it every day, and I know you don't like to listen to some of these shows. I do because I want to hear what our enemies are saying. This absolute hatred of unions and teachers' unions, they get caught up in this anti, and therefore anything that's an alternative to public schools and the teachers' union is good in their eyes, yet you don't hear information like what you just said. I mean, occasionally they'll bring a spokesman on, but for the most part, all you hear is the right-wing conservative talking points.
Yeah, they're shills. Look, they don't have a hard-held belief amongst them. It's what the corporate talking points
are.
I
understand that, but a lot of people, if that's all they hear, or the majority of the talk, if that's all they hear. Now, the people who call in are the hardcore conservatives.
No, they're paid.
Well, no, wait a minute. Not, a lot of the calls are not. I mean, because I know some of their voices. They are dyed-in-the-wool conservatives. And if all you hear is the anti, you're going to say, well, you know, maybe that isn't such a bad idea because I think it will save us money. No, it's not going to save us money. It's going to cost us a lot of money at the expense of the poor school districts who are just barely have their head above water now.
It is what it is, and again, I still come back to a lot of the anger against a lot of progress forward is this ill thought out distrust of others, which is why I think it was a good decision today. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit upheld the injunction against Arizona's SB 1070. When we come back, we're going to talk with Karen Tumlin. She's an attorney from Los Angeles, working on this case, going to give us a little background on this particular case and where it's going from here. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Karen Tumlin. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better. Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. The Washington State Capitol building in Olympia was buzzing last week with raucous protests. Chants that filled the Marble Building's rotunda echoed those heard in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, and more. In a move similar to Wisconsin, the Capitol was even occupied overnight by protesters wanting their voices to be heard in the morning sessions. The issues at stake in Washington mostly revolve around budget proposals by both Republicans and Democrats that would see social services and education funding slashed,
without any tax breaks or loopholes being addressed. Democrats hold a slight majority in both houses of the legislature, but due to a referendum passed in November, no taxes can be raised in the state without a two-thirds majority. That means the only way to balance the budget in the state without such a majority is by making drastic cuts. Some of the tax breaks protesters have recommended the legislature cut include incentives for filmmaking in the state and plastic surgery. Healthcare workers in the state went on strike Thursday to have their voices heard in the Capitol, even disrupting the House session to the point where they were asked to leave the gallery. Maureen Masterson is a clinician with Compass Health.
The denying seniors the right to remain in their homes with adequate trained care.
Right.
It deprives people who are residents and citizens of this state the right to have medical treatment and medication that they need. That's not a budget. That is immoral. Shame on you.
Shame on you!
Even as teacher unions are under unprecedented attacks to strip their union rights, the American Federation of Teachers is making significant gains organizing charter schools in Chicago. Doug Cunningham files this report.
Chicago has 85 charter schools. The AFT so far has organized 12 of them and intends to unionize them all. The Chicago Alliance of Charter Teachers and Staff is a united effort by the Chicago Teachers Union and the State and National American Federation of Teachers. The growing charter school movement often scapegoats teacher unions and diverts funds away from public education. Nationwide right now, more than 600 charter schools are unionized, but that's a small percentage of the total number of charter schools. The latest charter school to see teachers forming a union in Chicago is the Chicago Math and Science Academy. But so far, the administration there is refusing to recognize the teachers' union. Even as the AFT organizes more charter schools, the administrations of those charter schools in the city, by and large, are still anti-union and are fighting efforts by teachers and staff to get an organized voice on the job.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're a proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Well, today, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit upheld the injunction against Arizona's controversial immigration law, SB 1070. They're saying that this is a victory for the Obama administration. Personally, I think it's a victory for citizens of this country, but we will find out more. I've got Karen Tumlin on the line. She's a Los Angeles attorney, I think working on this or following it very closely. Karen, thanks for taking time for us.
My pleasure. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is your role in the SB 1070?
My organization, the National Immigration Law Center, along with several other civil rights organizations, actually filed one of the first lawsuits challenging Arizona's racial profiling law, SB 1070. So we have our own lawsuit challenging SB 1070, which is moving forward, and we also were amicus before the court in the federal government's lawsuit.
So this isn't yours, but this is one you were part of, this victory here today.
That's right.
So explain what it is that was decided today.
Sure. What was decided today is essentially that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the injunction, the preliminary injunction, that stopped key portions of SB 1070 from ever taking effect. And so today, really, the Ninth Circuit issued a very forceful statement that states lack the ability to regulate in the area of immigration, and that other states looking to enact Arizona lookalikes should really take heed.
Well, because here in Pennsylvania, we've got an insaniac who wants the same thing. In fact, last year, he was touting that as one of his claims to fame here in the state of Pennsylvania, which again, is one of these scary moments where you go, yeah, I expect insanity in Arizona, but not here in my backyard.
Right, and that's the House Bill 738, I think it is, which is very much modeled on Arizona's SB 1070, which was injunction was affirmed today. And if you look at the bill pending in Pennsylvania, there are key pieces that are essentially taken verbatim from the Arizona law.
I wouldn't doubt if
blocked by the court.
You know, knowing how lazy some of these guys are, I wouldn't doubt if it were the exact same bill. I wouldn't doubt that at all. So the provision in this that was most controversial to me, anyway, one of them was this idea that you could get reasonable suspicion that someone's an illegal immigrant. I would guess just by them being brown.
Right. And that is something, of course, that the courts have put on hold. And it really, I think, is a powerful statement about what our constitutional values are supposed to be. What would it mean to ask a law enforcement officer to decide why they would have reasonable suspicion that somebody is unlawfully present? And what law enforcement officials said, what the evidence in the case said, was there's no way to implement that in a race-neutral manner, in a way that doesn't call for judgments based on one's skin color, and that's inappropriate.
Now, they tried to, if I remember right, they tried to fix it up by saying, well, it's only if they're stopped for something other than that.
Right, and what the district court said below, and something that was an issue in our lawsuit, is you may be stopped for something, whether you're stopped on, you know, for a traffic infraction. But if then you're being held, your detention by that law enforcement official on the side of the road is prolonged merely because of a judgment that's made about how you look and whether or not you belong in this country, that's deeply problematic and it's unconstitutional.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, if you're not a citizen, if you are here in an undocumented fashion, and you get pulled over for speeding or whatever, would you have a driver's license?
You might, absolutely. In some states, you might have a driver's license, and you may have other valid form of identity. In most states, what you're asked to produce when you're in the course of a traffic stop is a valid form of identity and, of course, proof of registration and insurance. And if one produces those things, the law enforcement officer doesn't have any reason to be questioning your immigration status. And, again, what the court says today very clearly is, it is not a right or a power that local law enforcement has to enforce civil violations of what is a federal and uniform national immigration policy.
And that, I think, is the right decision. But then I guess the question should be is how do folks who are here in an undocumented fashion get driver's license or official documents if they're, and I'm, help me here, if they're not supposed to be here?
Well, so some states allow individuals to have driver's license regardless of their status. So that's one answer, of course. And certainly when I travel abroad to a foreign country, I am not a licensed driver in that place, but I can get an international driver's license. I may be able to drive in certain places depending on my passport, depending on what other documents I might have with me.
But you had a passport, you went through there, and I'm not trying to argue this with you, but I'm just trying to get a grasp of the right wing arguments that are going to come up with this, because you know, right. I'm trying to work my way through this myself. You know, I look at this and I say, if you're not here in a documented fashion, how do you get a driver's license?
Well, so I think that you have to take a step backward and remember this, that in under our long history of our immigration policy in the United States, undocumented status, you may be undocumented today and a lawful permanent resident tomorrow. Many people who are currently today undocumented, the federal government knows that they are here and they're in the process of getting status. They may be seeking asylum from a country that would persecute them if they were returned. And so what was at issue really poignantly in this lawsuit that was brought by the federal government against the state of Arizona was saying, wait a minute, Arizona, you don't get to decide who comes into the country and who has a lawful right to remain here. We get to make that decision, and in so doing, we have the bird's eye perspective of the federal government looking across many different national interests and doing a balancing act.
So where does this, now that the Ninth Circuit has ruled, where does it go from here?
What would happen next is the state of Arizona may choose to seek what's called an en banc review by the Ninth Circuit, which means a review by a fuller Ninth Circuit. Today's decision was by three judges. They have 45 days to make that decision, and they may make a formal request to have the larger Ninth Circuit hear the case. That's an intermediate step of appeal before they may ultimately choose to appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And, how expensive is that going to be? I guess how likely is it that Arizona will choose to do this, and how expensive does that, again, we're talking about tough times.
It's absolutely expensive and absolutely costly. I know that there have been reports about the millions of dollars that have been spent on the defense of this unconstitutional law already in Arizona. Without a question, it will be costly. And I think it may be likely. I do not believe that Arizona has spoken yet. I think they said they're considering their options. But in the past, before this decision issued, Governor Brewer made it very clear that she intends to fight this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Now, you guys, you have a suit with the National Immigration Law Center. As you said earlier, you'll continue forward, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Our lawsuit continues in the district court in Arizona, and we, in fact, have other challenges to the law on other constitutional bases on the First Amendment, on the Fourth Amendment, a search and seizure, and also based on the Equal Protection Clause that the U.S. government has not raised. We are challenging also the entire law, not only the four provisions that have been enjoined, and our lawsuit continues and is moving forward.
Well, let's hope that that goes the right way as well. I appreciate your information on this. Is there anything that I should have asked that I didn't? This isn't, you know, I'm with you on it. Is there anything I missed?
No, I mean, I think that the primary thing is that this is a very clear message from the Ninth Circuit that the decision today absolutely has an impact on other states. The state of Utah has passed already, has been signed into law, a copycat version of Arizona's SB 1070. It's a bill by the name of HB 497. It's scheduled to take effect on May 10th currently. And really, the opinion today should be read by state legislatures across the country, and they've got to ask themselves the question if they want to continue to fight a battle, which several courts now have said is a losing battle for states.
Well, it's not their money. They don't really care. It's the taxpayers' money. What do they care? Ms. Tumlin, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for the information.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Corporate America is back. The recession is over. Corporate profits rose by 47% last year, and those giants are now awash in cash, having some $2 trillion stashed in their vaults. So at last, the directors of corporate America are declaring that it's time for long-suffering employees to see their paychecks catch up to pre-recession levels. Great, huh? Oh, I hope you didn't think they meant your paycheck. No, no, bucko. It's the CEOs the directors are concerned about. While plain old workers did receive a 2% boost in their wages in the past year, practically every penny of this tiny increase was gobbled up by inflation. But top executives did much, much better, enjoying a median pay hike of 27% more than they got the previous year. This adds up to a nice round number of $9 million in pay for each of them. Of course, many did far better than that mid-level number. The barista-in-chief at Starbucks, for example, poured $21 million into his cup. The big cheese at Disney Inc. snapped up $28 million for his year at the helm of the Mickey Mouse Empire. Black & Decker's top tool got $32 million. But the biggest haul of all was made by the honcho of the media giant Viacom. He reeled in $84 million. Yes, I know they point to that 47% rise in overall profit levels as the reason these soaring paychecks are warranted, but take a closer peek at that number. The profit performance is mostly due to eliminating the jobs of thousands of workers last year and downsizing the hours and wages of others. Real profit, derived from increased sales, edged up by only 7%. This is Jim Hightower saying, how's that for shared sacrifice in hard times? Workers get offed, which artificially inflates the bottom line of the corporations, letting CEOs cash in on middle-class misery. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Or check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. That was a very painful interview. That was a tough one for me. Because I got to be honest, I don't know how you get a driver's license in an undocumented fashion. I just don't. Maybe that's something that the federal government should look at. But again, I think this decision was right and that this is not the a state's issue. This is clearly what the federal government should be doing, and they should have been doing for years. This is that kind of thing, and they've chose not to.
It's a tough issue, and I think at some point we need some guidance in these kind of decisions. At least give us a direction to go.
But the idea of pulling people over just because you're brown, if I get a really good tan, am I subject to stop and question? Where are your papers? Give me your papers. I want your papers. No, that's not the country I want to live in. Sorry.
No.
I don't know that I want to live in this country either. There's a company out there that's saying that they'll pay your mortgage. And Jake, I know you could use a couple of bucks, but you don't have a mortgage. But if you did, if you had a mortgage, this firm, Adzuki, they'll pay your mortgage for up to a year if you allow them to paint your house. If you allow them to paint your house with the advertisement of the company of their choice. Remember the old days, you go through the farms and Mail Pouch would paint the barns, and it was a great thing for the farmers. It was a great thing for
they still do that.
I don't know if they still do.
I see them around.
Yeah, they've been 20
well,
years ago.
Well, the new thing is, Rick, you just put a big sign up now.
Yeah, no more paint. But Adzuki will come. They'll paint your house, and it will be one of the many corporate.
What
corporate slogans? Your whole house. They'll paint the whole house.
Question. Are they going to paint your house and then put a sign up, or is the sign going to be your house?
No, your house is the billboard. They actually paint your house like a big billboard. And I go, if I really hated my neighbors, I would do that and then move.
Well, that's a question. Is that legal in some townships and municipalities?
I can't imagine that if you didn't live in a zone, in an area, like a community that's already put up one of these association communities, where you buy into this, like a co-op kind of thing. I would think you
condos.
Couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not more than condos, because I know people who live in developments where you can't put up a flagpole, you can't change the back of your house.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole bunch of restrictions when you buy into this community. That they've said right from the start, we're not letting you. We want our cookie cutter neighborhood. We want all the houses to look alike. We don't want any of that nonsense going on. There, I think you'd have a problem.
Well, I guess my question is, after 1 year, can you then paint it over?
No, the way they explains it, it's they'll pay your mortgage for a year.
And how long do you have to have that sign?
I guess as long as the paint lasts.
Well, I think you'd run into... That's obviously advertisement. I think you'd run into some zoning problems.
Well, it is what it is. But if you need money and you're having a tough time making the next year's mortgage, Adzuki.
And if you hate your neighbor, it's a two-for-one.
Wow. Wow. I don't hate my neighbors enough to ruin my house like that. AFP reports about 1 in 10 cancers in men and 1 in 33 cancers in women in Western Europe are caused by current and past alcohol consumption, according to this study released last Friday. Some of the types of cancer, the rates are significantly higher, according to the report. In 2008, for men, 44, 25, and 33% of upper digestive tract, liver, and colon cancer, respectively, were caused by alcohol in six of the countries examined. The countries were Britain, Italy, Spain, Greece, Germany, and Denmark. The study also showed that half of these cancers occurred in men who drank more than the recommended daily limit of 24 grammes of alcohol, roughly two small glasses of wine or a pint of beer per day. The cancer rates for women in the same countries, along with the Netherlands and France, was 18% for throat and mouth and stomach, 17% for liver, 5% for breast, and 4% for colon cancer. So, again, you know, we don't know.
No. Let me get a gauge on this now. A pint is what, about two beers?
No, it's one.
It's one?
Yeah.
Just one?
Yeah, a pint's not that much.
Okay. That's not a lot.
Not a lot at all. Like two cups. Isn't two cups a pint? If I remember my second grade math.
I think there were times in your life where you exceeded that guideline considerably.
No, come on, I exceeded. I remember a friend of mine worked at one of these catering clubs, you know, where they had weddings and stuff, one of these catering halls. He handed me a case of Little Kings, and this is a true story. Handed me a case of Little Kings, their little 7-ounce bottle, 24 of them in the case. And in the 2 miles that it took me to get from the party center to my house, I drank the entire 24 of them, leaving behind me a trail. So that when the police went back and picked up every bottle, they led right to my house. And they, of course, knew exactly.
You weren't exactly a Rhodes Scholar when you were young, were you?
Was not.
Reminds me of Rolling Rock. We used to have this 7-ounce Rolling Rock. Pittsburgh beer, never liked it, but some guys did.
No, Latrobe.
Latrobe? Okay, well, Pittsburgh area. Latrobe's not that far from
Pittsburgh. Latrobe.
Oh, it sounds like you partake of...
No,
the Rolling Rock.
No, you know,
pony bottles. We used
Cleveland.
To
Cleveland had their own miserable beers to deal with. POC was one of them. You know, basically Leak on Cleveland, only the different P word. Mm-hmm. Was one of them, and you know Schmitz. Who could pass up Schmitz?
But they used to have Schmitz. Used to have the low grade beer. I forget the name of it. I mean, it was. We used to call it Philadelphia sewer water, so that there gives you an idea what it tastes like.
I don't know how we got on a beer discussion, but there was absolutely nothing worse than when I lived in West Virginia than they had this beer called Stoney's. It looked like a kid took a black magic marker and wrote on a white label Stoney's. It was two cases for $6. This is back in the mid-'80s.
Cheap drunk, huh?
No, it was a horrible drunk. It was the worst. It was the worst rot gut that you ever drank. And again, we better get off the beer stories because no good.
Well, I could tell some wine stories, but I think we're past that.
But speaking of wine, though, later in the week, we're gonna be talking to Mike Sterla, Pennsylvania State Representative, about the sale of the wine and spirit shops. And I got to be honest with you, again, I go back to my years as a youth, who again, you know, probably drank a little bit too much. Maybe according to these studies, maybe I've got some throat cancer and some colon cancer in my future for as much as I drank. But I'm not in favor of selling off the wine and spirit shops. I think it's an asset to the state. If you want to partake in a couple of shots here or there, you should be able to. They're convenience stores. They're well stocked. I just don't think it should be on the shelf next to the Tic Tacs.
Well, what bothers me a little bit, Rick, and part of this is because certain organizations that, when they had this battle before, were involved, talking about the Mad Mothers, we're not talking at all. I think I heard someone talking about it on the radio in a talk show one time. The price to society, the price in added deaths on the highways, the price in crime involving alcohol, the price involving alcohol, involving underage drinking, it just sends the wrong message. Is that the kind of society we want? And who is to say, Rick, that in the future to make more profit, that the state will not double and triple the number of licensees? Who is to say they won't do that? Is that what we want? Do we want several?
I want to be like Washington.
Do we want several in every small town?
I want to be like Washington. I want to have a liquor store on every corner.
Sends the wrong message.
I want to have liquor and dry cleaning, and I want to have liquor and T-shirts, and I want to have liquor and postcards.
Just like a Big Mac.
I want to have liquor and Big Macs, and I want to have liquor and whatever. I want liquor everywhere. Although that didn't sound right. Anyway, the lead editorial in Sunday Scranton Times Tribune explains Governor Corbett's spending plan is based on a false premise. They say that the only way to balance the budget is by putting the screws to the working families while giving big rewards to big business. Instead, the Scranton Times Tribune said that it's time to diminish abundant corporate welfare, achieve fairer distributions of the overall tax burden, and mitigate the amount of sacrifice that the governor and lawmakers plan to impose upon school children, college students, and the poor. How do they go about doing this? So if we're not going to stick it to the kids, we're not going to stick it to the poor, we're not going to kick granny to the curb, what do we do? Well, they say by making sure that corporate interests are paying their fair share, starting with the drilling tax and closing corporate loopholes. Southwestern Pennsylvania's Observer reported likewise that Corbett's failure to support a drilling tax borders on the fiscally criminal. So which will it be, you have to ask yourself. And we already know the answer. It's not going to be common sense. It's going to be corporate special interests. But what I find interesting is you finally got some of these newspapers, these editorial boards coming around going, wait a minute, this is getting a little far-fetched for us to buy into. Because you got to understand, most of the editorial boards are very conservative. Not likely to go against their conservative governor. But in this case, it's just insane. Plain nuts that we're telling, my kids, sorry, can't afford you to have an education. Sorry. Good luck. Good luck with poverty. Just plain nuts.
Well, the sad part about it is, and I think they see it, it's not just the governor's pledge. It's the fact that it seems his position seems to be coming from a deeply held political ideology. And who's paying the price? The children. And that's sad.
Amazing, amazing stuff. So over the weekend, the Insaniacs, or I shouldn't say that, not Insaniacs. They're the revolution. The revolution. Conservative group that, in the word revolution, love is backwards. So this is revolution with love. Revolution with love. They had their Insanapalooza, and they had a straw poll, and the straw poll was quite interesting of Pennsylvania conservatives, who they chose for president. The number one choice for Pennsylvania conservatives was Mr. the Pizza Man, Godfather Pizza CEO, Herman Cain, the African American talk show host, followed by Michelle Bachmann, followed by Tim Pawlenty, by then Donald Trump, Ron Paul, Rick Santorum finished sixth, Sarah Palin and Mitch Daniels tied for seven, Mitt Romney and Mike Huckleberry tied for ninth, and of course, Haley Babar finished a dead last in 11th. I find it interesting, though, that you got Huckleberry saying that he might consider Donald Trump as a vice presidential poll, which I think just torpedoed Huckleberry's chances. But again, this is one group of really crazy people who've said, we want Herman Cain. And I can't understand why. I mean, if you've actually heard the guy speak, politically, he doesn't seem to be all that astute. And, he doesn't even get the talking point right. Michelle Bachmann, I love, because she's comic genius. The one that I'm really afraid of, really the one that I really think could give Obama the biggest trouble, is Pawlenty. Because he's not nearly as crazy as the rest of the field. Rick Santorum, forget him. He's trying to out-creep everybody. And I think he'll succeed. He will be the creepiest candidate of this electoral cycle. Bet on that. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break right back after this with Victoria Jones from the Talk Radio News Service. We want the world.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. And now from Washington, D.C., Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
What's going on? What's the news on the budget deal?
The budget deal. Well, basically, everybody's waiting for the vote now, which is likely to be on Wednesday. And, you know, it's probably going to be closer than people have been saying. There was a lot of smiling and backslapping over the weekend. But the reality seems to be that you had 28 conservative Republicans who voted against it early Saturday morning, 42 mostly liberal Democrats who voted against, and then you're getting some conservative Republicans who are now saying that, yes, they voted for it, now they're going to vote against it. And so Speaker Boehner may have to scramble to find the votes he needs. I think he's going to get them, yes, but I think I don't think that this is going to be a slam dunk.
Well, they were for it before they were against it, and interesting stuff going on there. And,
yeah.
And what I've been saying is this is going to be trouble for Boehner because he can't keep his house in order. He's not the way.
At the moment, he's looking like he won, and he's looking like he won good for the conservatives. So I think the trouble is more likely to come if he can't deliver for them on the 2012 budget or on the debt ceiling.
Well, in talking about the debt ceiling, which, you know, is coming up quickly, what are you hearing on that?
Well, basically, the president wants a clean bill. In other words, he wants a bill that just raises the debt ceiling and doesn't have all sorts of things attached to it. But they're not saying whether they would veto something that did have things attached. However, the Republicans are already saying that they're going to extract a heavy price. Senator Jeff Sessions was saying over the weekend that the White House shouldn't think they're just going to waltz in here, it was the phrase he used, and just have anything they want. And Speaker Boehner said there will not be an increase in the debt limit without something really, really big attached to it. So certainly there is a feeling on the Republican side that if they have the wind with them and that they can extract a pound of flesh.
I'm sure they can. And I got to be honest, you know, what we were talking about over the weekend is, you know, on Friday, the Democrats kept giving ground. And it wasn't until the last minute that the Republicans said, oh, well, you know, okay, the abortion thing, we'll fight that next time.
Exactly. And, of course, that is going to come up next time. It's not over at all.
No, of course not. You know, they're going to keep it there to keep Democrats moving. And because, as Dick Cheney has said in the past, it's what they do. They cave. It is what they do.
And, you know, and they're not all like that. There are some tough Democrats, but they were not the ones doing the negotiating.
Yeah. I like Harry Reid. I think he's a good senator. I just don't want him as the majority leader. And what's going on? I guess the Court of Appeals has upheld part of the Arizona immigration law?
Well, what it's saying, it's going to block part of it from taking effect. This is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that does California, some of the West Coast. It upheld the lower court ruling, so it handed the Obama administration a victory in its efforts to overturn the law. What it basically did was it put on hold some provisions of the law which empowers police to question people whom they have a reasonable suspicion are illegal immigrants. And so the bill, among other things, requires police to check immigration status if they stop someone while enforcing other laws. So the court said, I don't think so. So they didn't say that the Arizona law is legal, but they did say that the lower court judge's order should be upheld. And the Justice Department is going to go ahead to try and have the entire law declared unconstitutional. I haven't heard what Arizona's governor is going to do. I'm quite sure she's going to appeal. But the judges really have some very stern language about this. And they gave an indication that they would probably find this unconstitutional. Judge Richard Payers said in the majority opinion, for those sympathetic to immigrants to the United States, it is a challenge and a chilling foretaste of what other states might attempt.
Yeah, we've got a crazy guy here in Pennsylvania who wants to do the same thing.
Really?
Yeah, I think every state has their nut job, and we've got ours.
It's America. Yeah. It's the American way.
There you go. Some information on Bradley Manning?
Yeah, very interesting, this one. The UN investigator on torture today has accused the U.S. administration of blocking a one-on-one meeting that he was seeking with detained WikiLeaks soldier Bradley Manning. Argentine lawyer Juan Mendez says he's been trying to organize a visit to check on his condition since back in December. And you know that Manning's been held because of the investigation of WikiLeaks charges.
Right.
Well, he says he was deeply disappointed and frustrated by the prevarication. He met from both State and Defense Department officials, and they made it clear that they would only allow him to talk to Manning with a prison official present. And Mendez, who's an independent expert who reports to the UN Human Rights Council, he says that a monitored conversation would violate his job's requirement for private, confidential, and unsupervised interviews with detainees alleging torture and ill treatment.
Yeah, how is it we can go around the world and take the moral high ground if right here in our backyard we're doing this kind of stuff?
It does seem to be questionable.
Any news on Libya?
Well, yes. The African Union was visiting Gaddafi and his regime yesterday and got an agreement to a ceasefire out of him with certain conditions, one of which was for negotiation, not various other bits, but negotiation. So they went to Benghazi, the rebel stronghold, today. Where they didn't get a very warm welcome. And the rebels basically said no. And they said no because there's nothing in there about Gaddafi leaving the country or stepping down. Negotiations means nothing. Also, they really don't trust the African Union.
Yeah, I don't trust anybody over there. And in Yemen?
Yemen's interesting because an organization of the Gulf States has been trying to broker something there whereby Saleh would step down, President Saleh would step down. We don't know exactly when. And he has accepted the deal. But again, the opposition has rejected it because it would offer him immunity.
Oh, beautiful.
He likes the idea.
I would too. Immunity for all the stuff that you've done. And plus, you get to take a pot of gold with you. Who couldn't like that kind
Not
of
bad.
Thing?
Not bad.
Victoria Jones, I appreciate your time. Feel better.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News Service. And now to find out what's going on here, what do you got for us?
Yeah, Rick, there's kind of a lighthearted jab at the Republicans in the straw poll that was taken recently. Did former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty win with 26 first-place votes? Question mark. Or did the business leader Herman Cain get the most votes if votes were tallied for the first and second place choices? The poll conducted by Pennsylvania Revolution, as you spoke of earlier in the show, Rick, showed that the wide field of potential candidates plays choices across the ideological map. Pawlenty has formed his exploratory committee. Michelle Bachmann, your girlfriend, Rick, has become the face of the Tea Party. While Sarah Palin decides on and off on a regular basis whether she's going to run, Bachmann vowed to be a one-term president. Mitt Romney is having the Romney Care Massachusetts healthcare initiative feted by Democrats, and Donald Trump has grabbed hold of the mainstream media's need to ride the ratings machine, giving his birther tendencies new publicity. All of these 2012 presidential hopefuls and potentials are on the prowl, and we haven't even mentioned former Senator Rick Santorum from the state of Pennsylvania, whose bid for the most outlandish candidate moniker is getting competition from Bachman, Rand, and Ron Paul. Santorum ran 9th out of 11th in the Pennsylvania straw poll, but won in South Carolina, where he has spent many days campaigning over the past year. Recent poll came out from Pennsylvania of showing the favor accountability standards for school vouchers on what could be the eve of a possible school voucher vote in the state Senate. A poll shows 3 out of 4 Pennsylvania survey favor certain accountability for money spent on taxpayer-funded vouchers for parents to use to send their children to a private school. Today, the Senate Appropriations Committee is expected to consider amendments to Senate Bill 1, School Choice Bill, sponsored by Senator Jeff Pecola, who's a Republican from Dauphin County, and Anthony Williams, a Democrat from Philadelphia. This could put the legislation in a position to be considered by the full Senate on Tuesday or Wednesday. The poll of about 807 Pennsylvania adults conducted last month by Terry Madonna's Opinion Research found this. 76% strongly or somewhat favor requiring achievement tests of private schools that accept vouchers. Nearly 82% strongly or somewhat favor requiring private schools accepting vouchers to report graduate and student achievement rates. 88% strongly or somewhat favor voucher accepting private schools to be required to report financial data. Survey has a margin error of plus or minus 3.4. An earlier survey Madonna conducted found 2 of every 3 polled opposed giving public-funded vouchers to parents to send their children to private schools. The Pennsylvania School Board Association continues to argue that taxpayer-funded tuition vouchers are unaccountable, unpopular, unproven, unaffordable, and unconstitutional, and the group's according to the group's executive director, Thomas Gensel. President of the League of Women Voters of Pennsylvania echoed that anti-voucher sentiment. At a time when the governor is proposing a budget that would take $1 billion from public schools in the coming year, we cannot afford to add this costly program to cuts that schools are already facing, said the League's president, Olivia Thorne, and I concur with that. Give you an idea how powerful the teabag movement, Tea Party movement, to be kind to them, has done. There's a county over east from where we are right now. We're in Dauphin County. Over is in Lennon County, and they're having one heck of a squabble over there. Seems that what happened, the woman who was leading the party, Rick, took an assignment to work for a congressional candidate. The vice chairman at that point said, well, I'm taking over. There was a Tea Party favorite who then was actually pushed into that position, but took the position that, well, the majority of the people on the committee want me. And as of now, there's been a stalemate. It's really divided the party from the old guard to the new Tea Party people. They basically come from what something called the 912 Project, which off and on we talked about. And what they've done, they've gone to the state chairman and have him mediate this. This thing has gotten ugly. There have been some key people who have resigned from the committee. But it shows you the power. I mean, 2 years ago, many of these people weren't even the committee people in the Republican Party. They ran en masse. They got a large number of people. And now they're almost to the point where they're controlling the party. And that seems to be symptomatic of what's happening not only in this state but all over the country. And that's to some degree, that's a troubling development. Top owners get sick leave, not so much at the bottom of the wage scale. This is an article out of the AFL-CIO website. Workers at the top of the wage scale are now more than 4 times more likely to have paid sick days than workers toiling near the bottom scale. According to the new Policy Institute, just 19% of low-wage workers have paid sick days compared with 86% of high-wage workers. These low-income workers are the ones who can least afford to lose pay when they're sick. Overall, 1 in 4 workers have no sick day paid, and when they become ill, are forced to go to work sick, or they stay home without pay and risk losing their jobs. Many of these low-wage workers are also in occupations most likely to have regular contact with the public. We're talking about food service and preparation, personal care and service, according to a study earlier this year from the Institute for Women's Policy Research. And that, says Dr. Robert Drago, research director for WPR, raises serious health care concerns. The fewer the number of workers who are able to stay home when sick, the more likely it is that diseases will spread, increasing health care costs and causing needless economic losses. We saw this during the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, when workers without sick pay days were more likely to go to work when infected with H1N1.
Tom?
Yes, sir.
All right, we'll take a quick break. Quick break. We'll be right back after that.
Thought-provoking, intelligent conversation with the heart, the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well?
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard of Republicans today? Have you tried to spread your love?
Have you hugged a Republican today? That's the big question. You know, today I drove by the post office and there was a guy out there with a "We Hate Obama" sign and a whole bunch of literature. And I love those people. And I walked by him. I said, you know, keep it up with the Obama and the Hitler mustache. That's right there. You're gonna bring a lot of moderates over with that kind of display. And
yeah,
good for you.
But did you hug him?
No, I didn't. You know,
no, you didn't.
No. I'm not the huggy type. I'm not. You know, I know some people are. I'm not. I'm the, you know, I'd rather smack you upside the back of the head type. That's just me, though. Anyway, some good news. Evidently, we're a track star. Carl Lewis may be running for New Jersey State Senate. You know, he's getting up there in age a little bit, so probably not a gold medal in his future. But, you know, the gold medalist... 9-time gold medalist.
He was a great athlete.
From 1984 to 1996, announced that he may that he's going to seek a state senate seat in New Jersey. Because look, I mean, they've gone nuts. The Republicans in New Jersey had just they had a chance. You know, the voters said, well, you know, things aren't going so well. We're kind of bummed out. We're kind of angry. So we'll let some of the crazy people in. They voted for John Runyon, who I don't think is going to get a second term. I think a lot of these T-Twizzlers are not going to see a second term.
I guess I have a question about Runyon. Was he from the peninsula up there? He went to the University of Michigan. Was he from the conservative area of Michigan?
Well, I mean, that's where Mackinac's at. You know, where our buddy...
up in the wilderness.
Where Brillo.
Oh, my.
Where Brillo Pad.
You're assuming that he's going to be a progressive, Carl.
Well, he's going to be a Democrat. You don't know where he's going to stay. And I'm still waiting to see some of his positions. I haven't seen his website's not fully functional yet. So I'm looking forward to that.
I mean, anybody that was in four, I believe you said 12-year span, so that would be three Olympics at his level, has to have just a tremendous amount of self-motivation. Now, if he's trying out for the Olympics singing team, he's a little, you know, he's a little short, but all kidding aside, you know, we need some reasonableness in New Jersey. They seem to be going off of the deep end. And New Jersey for a long time was a progressive state.
Run, Carl, run! So good for him. It'd be nice to try and get him on the program. Anyway, today, big news from D.C. The mayor in Washington, D.C., along with several of the council members, were arrested on Capitol Hill today. The mayor ended up getting locked up, getting the silver bracelets on his wrists. You know, here's the thing. They're kind of ticked off. And I guess I don't blame them. They're kind of ticked off because evidently the funding that was saved for Planned Parenthood has now gone to Planned Parenthood, but away from the city of D.C. So D.C.'s kind of not happy about the loss of funding. And, you know, you got a city who's, you know, going, well, what do we do now? So they took to the streets, and good for them. It's great to see mayors out there willing to get themselves arrested. The Washington Post reported that the Capitol police officers let the protesters sit in the streets for 30 minutes, and then they began arresting them. There were well over 200 people who sat down in the middle of Constitution Avenue near the Senate Hart Building, chanting, "Hey ho, no, no, those D.C. rioters have got to go, and no justice, no peace." So, you know, it's good to see people getting into the "we need to get out in the streets" mentality. Again, you know, I'm surprised that they only arrested a handful. It would have been nice to see, it'd be nice to see 200 people drug away. That'd be good for the evening news. Oh, wait a minute. Do you think the evening news would cover it? Do you think fake news on Fox would cover it?
Probably not.
Probably not at all. And, you know, here's the thing that bothers me. You know, that whole budget discussion, really, really kind of ticks me off because, again, the Democrats do what they do best, you know, concede, and they did concede an awful lot. But to me, again, you know, we go to this whole discussion about how's money being allocated, what's the best way. Now we see from AFP, who's reported that the cost of the war in Libya for us, for the U.S., has reached $608 million, according to a U.S. defense official. He reported that today. The cost estimate covers the period from the start of the international airstrikes in Libya on March 19th to April 4th. Now, again, you know, I love these officials who speak on the condition of anonymity. The U.S. officials previously had said the operation had cost $550 million through March 28th. The Pentagon has estimated that the air campaign will cost the U.S. about $40 million a month. And again, I go back to this. I was against it from the beginning. I thought it was dumb to get involved in it because we don't know which side we're on. All we know is we're not on Gaddafi's side, even though we don't know if the other guys are our friends or not. Seems kind of dumb for me to get into the middle of that mess. That's what the international community is for. That's what they should have done. That's what their neighbors should have done, not us. But, you know, hey, that's just my opinion on this. Anyway, today in labor history, Ford Motor Company signed its very first contract on this day back in 1941 with the United Auto Workers. Also today, back in 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first black ball player hired by a Major League Baseball team. He plays his first game with the Brooklyn Dodger today at Ebbets Field. Today also in 1980, 34,000 New York transit workers started an 11-day strike for higher wages. They ended their walkout with an agreement on 9% increase the first year and 8% the second year, along with cost of living protections. Do you ever remember an 8% increase? The good old days. Back when people had bank accounts that, you know, actually paid more than 0.75%. Also today, back in 1980, the EEOC issued regulations prohibiting sexual harassment of workers by supervisors in the workplace. The year was 1980. And, you know, you listen to that nitwit woman that earlier from Virginia, Radke. She's running against Governor, former Senator Makaka, who said, well, you know, women are treated just like men. Just like men. They're equals. I got a question. I gotta see her facts first. Let her cite her sources. I gotta see this. But understand, it's only been 31 years that sexual harassment in the workplace has been something that had regulations attached to it. 31 years. And what you've got is you've got these conservatives, like that Radke woman who wants to be the uber conservative, saying, oh, we want to go back to the good old days, where the boss could come in and say, I like that dress you got. Show me a little of that. Yeah, oh, yeah, bend over there.
And while you're at it, give me a cup of coffee.
Yeah, go get my laundry.
Run an errand for my wife.
Yeah.
We're being facetious here, but
no, there's no facetious about it. That's
close,
the old days.
That's pretty close to what the way a lot of women.
You know, my aunt called me one day and said, you know, somebody had offered her a job as a Girl Friday. What exactly is that? And I said, basically, you're...
Anything the boss?
Yeah, I said, basically, you're his wife. You do whatever. Also, today, in 1986, police in Austin, Minnesota, used tear gas against striking Hormel meatpacking workers. 17 strikers were arrested on felony riot charges. No policemen for shooting them with tear gas.
I remember that strike. It was ugly.
It was brutal.
And brutal and vicious. If I can take just 30 seconds, right? Jackie Robinson. I mean, that man did more for civil rights than almost anybody, except maybe Martin Luther King. But he endured just such tremendous harassment for several years. And he knew that he couldn't strike out. He had to take it. And eventually his teammates came to his rescue. But he set the stage for literally thousands of black players to make a good living. And he deserves an awful lot of credit.
Yep. I want to thank everybody who was here today, all of our guests, the long line of them. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And, of course, I want to thank our chief engineer and chief knob twister over there, Brett, for keeping everything sounding perfect and moving right along. Again, you can visit thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. I look forward to having you back here again tomorrow night, every weeknight, 9 to midnight. Have a great night. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous array. Democracy is coming.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.